With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This plan sounded a hell of a lot better when we were going by motorboat. How far is this place? Around that point. Not more than a couple hours.
Oh, joy.
You all right?
I saw Kate.
What?
Last night. In the jungle. Before the last flash. Delivering Claire's baby.
That was 2 months ago.
Time travel's a bitch.
Get out!
Battle!
I think they want their boat back!
Boom!
Are these your people?
No, they're yours!
Shut up and keep battling!
Down the hatch, it's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recaps, talking Season 5, Episode 4, The Little Prince. I'm Josh Wigler. I'm joined here by a Little Prince, Mike Bloom.
Josh, it was me. I'm in the other outrigger.
I figured. I didn't even bother to ask. I don't know why this has been such like a big mystery for all this time, when it's very clear that it was Mike Bloom who was in the other outrigger.
Damon and Carlton have tried to put my name out there, but they say like it's too obscure. But now that I've finally, because they have access to time travel, of course, and knew we'd be starting a podcast many years later about Lost, they can now officially come out, say my name. I'll admit the reasoning behind it. I was shooting at Miles because he is so freaking annoying in this episode. I'm sorry, everyone else, that you had to be lumped in on that outrigger. But unfortunately, you're sort of like, sideways casualties of the fact that I was just aiming for Miles in particular.
Now, the sideways is a full season from now. We don't need to talk about that until we have to talk about it. But Mike, we do have to talk about the mysterious other outrigger, the only question regarding Lost that Damon and Carlton will never answer, according to Damon and Carlton themselves. I think that this episode, if you remember The Little Prince, you remember it as the outrigger episode that you probably
remember. It's a big if, yeah.
You probably remember the outrigger before you remember the episode itself. I think that does disservice to a very solid episode of Lost.
I do not disagree.
I think The Little Prince is good.
I mean, listen, I'm going to throw this claim out here, Josh, and I'm prepared for the fire arrows to take me. I liked watching The Little Prince this time around a smidge more than I liked watching Jughead.
I'm not surprised to hear it because I bet like the expectations were really low.
The expectations were really low. On top of that,
the expectations for Jughead were probably relatively high.
Absolutely. And look, let me also say that like the difference is really negligible. We'll get to that when it comes to my own rating for this episode. I think it also comes down to maybe preferences. You know, Jughead is more of, I would say, a plot-based episode. It's an exciting episode, but a plot-based episode at that. I think The Little Prince is chock full of character stuff that I really love. I know that we heap a lot of praise onto Jughead for planting seeds, planting bombs, if you will, really foreshadowing a lot of big moments that are going to happen in season 5. The Little Prince kind of does that too. This is a big episode for Sawyer. This is a big episode for Kate. This is where Locke's going to make a pretty pivotal decision as well. This is another episode where I think if you look at it on the surface, probably a little bit of a nothing burger at the time. But watching it back, this actually pivots some characters in incredibly key directions. I will also admit that maybe my own preference comes from the fact that it's not coincidental. Last week, only two characters that originated back in season 1 were in that episode. This is a episode chock full of season 1 references, Josh. And my nostalgia goggles were on.
Yeah.
They were fogged up because I was so happy. This was ever since we heard they were doing time travel, I was like, I just can't wait for when they inevitably go back to the time that they were on the island. Are they going to encounter themselves? What's going to happen? And even though we only dote on it for a brief period of time, it leads to some really beautiful moments.
Yeah, I agree. I think The Little Prince like falls into this category of episodes of Lost that are like extremely my shit, which is that when you have like many, if not all, of the Lost characters are just like kind of like moving with urgency. And so like all throughout this episode, everybody is just like kind of on the go in a very stressful way. There is now this time bomb element, literally with the time travel, as we have all of the people. I guess the literal time bomb is later in the season, but there is this ticking time bomb quality to the time travel storyline where now multiple people's noses are bleeding. And now we know that that is very bad. And so, like, it's surprising when Miles's nose starts to bleed. It's scary when Juliet's nose starts to bleed. You do get the, they're trekking from, like, the heart of the jungle to get back to the beach so that they can circle around so that they can get to the spot a little bit faster. So there is, like, you know, the people are on a mission quality to this episode as they're tripping through time. Yet we also do have these moments where we're able to like stop down for something smaller and sentimental, like watching the birth of Aaron, and to like canonize the fact that it wasn't just Claire and Kate and Jin and Charlie who were there, but Sawyer was there as well, and John Locke was almost there as well. it's really amazing, and the sense of forward momentum extends beyond the island stuff. Like that's very prevalent in the off island stuff too. Like people are just going. There's a huge action scene in this one where Saeed once again gets his assassin on. We've got like Jack is like running to like link up with Kate. Like people are just like rushing to meet with each other. So it feels like the trains are really, really going in this episode. There's an episode of season 6. I feel like I've said this on the podcast before, but it's probably been a while. There's an episode of season 6 that I think like you just like don't even remember, but is one of my favorite final season episodes, and I'm actually excited to get to it when we get to it. It's The Last Recruit. It's the one right before The Candidate. And it's an episode that like I think about very fondly, both because like I got to do something really cool professionally around that episode, so I was just inclined to enjoy it a little bit more, but also because it's like sort of the last Lost episode of a certain type where you just have the character going, and they're like they're coalescing and they're going, and I feel like that is very much the case here in The Little Prince, where both of these storylines, you've got like everybody who's left behind, they're urgently rushing towards something, and then all of the people that are off the island, for the most part, whether or not they are physically in the same place by the end of it, though many of them are, they are being like corralled into this spot. So the stuff is going, and I love that about this episode. And that like that doesn't like, you know, even touch on just like some of like the great little bits of dialogue here and there, some really great performances. I think For some people, Kate as Aaron's mom just does not land. It really lands with me. And like the performance that she gives Evangeline Lilly in this episode, the performance from Josh Holloway is really mesmerizing as well.
Really. I mean, like I said, this is a really foundational Sawyer episode. We've talked about the transition for a long time. And I agree that I think there is a momentum to this episode, but it's not just moving forward. To me, this is about moving on, almost, yeah. Right? That Kate off-island is dealing with this idea of moving on. She has been one of the people to insist to Jack, I refuse to go back. We see, though, that she is still sort of haunted by what she left behind on the island. And so it's this idea of her trying to move forward while at the same time, what she suspects are demons from her past are trying to haunt her. At the same time, we are experiencing this with Sawyer. Essentially, this is the episode of how Sawyer got over Kate, if I may boil it down to his storyline, is that I think in watching her again, he's going to talk about this later with Juliet, and also sort of parsing things out surprisingly through John Locke, of all people, he's going to learn to do what Jack can't do and learn to let things go and essentially say, like, she's gone, let me move on here. It's also, we're going to get into this actually with the very first scene and first sound of this episode in a few minutes. This is actually a pretty big episode for our endgame pairings as well. It's a big Jack and Kate episode. It's a big Juliet and Sawyer episode as well. So this episode could kind of be officially subtitled like The Death of Skate as well, in that it really seems like this foundationally says Sawyer and Kate are going to go off in different directions right now.
Well, it's not unlike the song. I believe the lyrics were, he was a skater boy, but he said, see you later, boy. And I think we could amend that to, he was a skater boy. Now he's a jater boy, because this is a good Jack and Kate episode.
Right. I think that, is there a comma before boy?
Yeah. He was a skater. We have to take the boy.
There we go. Exactly. Well, okay. We're going to get that line said a couple times in this episode. Mr. Not-So-Friendly in the form of Dan Norton makes his second appearance.
We'll talk about Dan Norton. We'll talk about all of this. We're going to talk about the full episode first. Hey, it's the start of a month. This is the time. You've been waiting for it. This is the moment you have been waiting to become a patron of Post Show Recap. Start of the month is always the best time to sign up. You get charged by Patreon as soon as you sign up, so you want to get as much of the month as you possibly can when you sign up. It's really early on. This is the time to sign up to get all of the amazing exclusive content that you get when you are a patron of Post Show Recaps. Especially at that $5 level, you are getting tons of podcasts, including early access to Down the Hatch, which posts in the main feed on Fridays, but posts early for patrons of Post Show Recaps on Wednesdays. You can travel through time. You can get episodes of Down the Hatch 2 days earlier than everybody else. On top of that, you're supporting your favorite podcast. And we know this is your favorite one.
Of course.
Listen, much like the others, we have the dossier. We do have access to your podcast feeds. We know that...
We know your real name.
We know that this is the one that you are listening to the most. We know that, like, you're like, oh, man, I love Down the Hatch. I love these guys, these stupid idiots who are talking about Lost every single week. I want to support these guys making content. I want them to make more content. This is the way to do it. Support us. It's $5 a month. If you can do $5 a month, you get exclusive podcasts. If you can do $10 a month, you get exclusive podcasts, and you get access to the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord. As Stefan would say, the hottest place on the internet is the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord. Join
us
there.
It's got everything. It's got a casino, Brand Steel, Dungeons and Dragons.
We're now playing an MMO. The patrons of Post Show Recaps in the Discord have started playing Final Fantasy 14 together. I'm playing it. If you'd like to play an online video game with me, I'm around. I'm available. That's $10 a month, but the podcasts are $5 a month. If you can swing it, we would so appreciate it, especially as I've made this move to full-time podcasting. I would greatly appreciate it. So that's the pitch. That just getting it out of the way early. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. You've been waiting for the time. The time is nigh. It's now. Postshowrecaps.com/Patreon or Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Both of those will get you there. One last time for good measure. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Let's talk about The Little Prince, Mike. It's named after the book.
Yes, Le Petit Prince. Did you ever... No, Pitch Perfect, right?
Le Petit Prince. Yeah, you don't want to support that. You don't want to support Mike Bloom.
You know what, actually, if we get to a certain level should we do of a Patreon subscribers, that... I will read The Little Prince in that Vichy accent.
Should we do a stretch goal where if like we get 50 patrons, Mike will sign up to take French?
Okay. I'll do that. I will legitimately, Josh, you know, if I make a bet, I will go through on it. I will 108% sign up to take a French class.
That is hysterical. Okay, so here it is, the spontaneous goal. if we hit 550 patrons by the end of June, Mike Bloom will sign up to take French class.
Yes, and then I can lead Le Petit Prince.
How many weeks of French class would you be willing to take?
I mean, all of them.
The weeks you'll learn the language, like you're guaranteeing you're going to learn it? You're going to learn French?
I mean, listen, if anything has taught us this past year, right, there's no time like the present. That's what John Locke's really putting forward as well, right? Like, you have to move forward, no looking back. I'm going to grab an opportunity by the reins, and I'm going to ride it. In this case, it might be a horse in the form of a new language. So, yeah, give me, like, the Muzzy tapes or the Duolingo or whatever I need to do. I'll learn French.
This is the dumbest thing. But if anyone wants to make this happen, tell your friends, tell your siblings, tell your everybody. We need to teach Mike Bloom French.
I don't know. I speak it magnifique right now.
We're 50 patrons away from getting Mike Bloom French class. So it's The Little Prince. It's based off the book Le Petit Prince.
By Antoine de Saint-Exupéry.
Tell us about the Little Prince in English, please.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let me make sure that my throat doesn't give out with my French voice.
Oh my God.
For those that haven't read it, because I do believe actually, it is a part of some people's curriculums, in the English classroom specifically, but it is a classic book originally in French, as alluded to, translated into English, where essentially it's about a person who, some of you heard this before, survives a plane crash and befriends the titular little prince, who is a boy who lived on an asteroid and basically is talking about like, oh, he was living on this planet with, I think, like a sentient rose. And he found that it was inhospitable for them to live together. And he left to sort of explore the
Bernard
universe.
Bernard also lives with a sentient rose.
Yes, luckily very sentient. Thank you, Ireland, to make sure that rose does not wilt anytime soon. So there are a couple connections here, right? This is the second Kate episode in a row where maybe the title's a bit nebulous. Of course, we figured out our own internal rationale for Eggtown. I don't know if we'll do that for The Little Prince.
Is it not just Aaron? Is Aaron not the Little Prince?
So, and it's like... Yes. Yeah, so I know that the book, in the book, he's described, like, the titular little prince as a young, blonde-haired child. But I do think there's also this idea of, like, going out and exploring your world and realizing that, like, the actions speak louder than words, I think is one of the foundational messages of the piece. It should also be mentioned that the prince lives on an asteroid whose name is the same name of the boat that was Daniel Rousseau et al. Were on when it sank.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah.
That's another fun thing as well, is once you know that this is going to also usher in a little bit of French as well without me learning it in the form of Daniel Rousseau in the 80s, it also makes like the duality of this title a little bit fun as well.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good name for the episode. I do think it's like this is probably not doing the episode any favors that it's called The Little Prince, because you just like you don't really remember why that's called The Little Prince. I feel like we're just like not really like hooking it on to anything. I feel like you could call it the Outrigger. You could call it like, I don't know. You could call it jet lag, you know, to like hook it to what Faraday says. It's like really bad jet lag. There's a bunch of different options here. I just don't think that The Little Prince quite does it for me.
Yeah, well, I think it specifically applies. Though I guess, you know, we have sort of been dealing with, especially these past few episodes, like Jughead doesn't necessarily talk about the Desmond side of things, right?
Unless like, he's like Jughead. Put a crown on him. I bet he would eat tons of nothing burgers.
He's our queen now. But like this place is death. I guess can sort of refer to off violent stuff, but I think unfortunately one of the disadvantages of the dual stories we have going on right now is that there isn't necessarily a title that can cover all. Maybe they're sort of alternating, right? Where last week was the on island title, now they're going with the off island title. I agree. I don't think it's a fantastic game. I think there is more there than people may think, especially compared to an episode like Eggtown, but I would not herald it as one of the great episode titles or even like a great Kate episode title.
Yeah, for sure. All right.
What about Who Kate Raised?
Who Kate Raised? Yes. Okay, so let's get into the episode proper. We begin, I do think, as we discussed last week, like this is kind of the signifiers. Like, where does the episode start? We talked about this even as far back as The Lie with Hurley. Where does the episode begin? That is like basically, that's like sort of your centricity through line. This isn't quite a Kate episode, but Kate is very heavily involved. And
yeah, I would say this is, I believe actually when they did some behind the scenes taping, I believe it initially is regarded as a Kate and Sawyer episode. And much like last week, I think you could regard it as that.
I mean, I do think that there is an argument that it's like, it's a Jate's Gate episode. Like there is so much that's happening with Juliet and Sawyer and with Jack and Kate that like this is sort of like one of those major moments for these two characters, these two sets of characters rather, and the four of them all told. But it does begin with this flashback scene that I do think pins much of the emotional energy on Kate Austin. We start off two nights after the escape from the island. Now they're on Penny's boat. Yes, Penny's boat. And a conversation occurs between Jack and Kate. Let's listen in.
Oh, you don't have to whisper. When he's out, he's out.
Well, at least one of us can sleep.
It's going to take more than two nights for me to get used to sleeping in a normal bed. What are we going to do about him? About Aaron?
I don't know.
Been thinking a lot about it. Did you know that Claire was flying to LA to give him up for adoption?
No, I didn't.
We should say he's mine.
What?
We could say that I was 6 months pregnant when I was arrested and that I gave birth to him on the island. No one would ever know.
Kate, no, you don't have to. There's other ways to do this.
After everyone we've lost, Michael, Jin, and Sawyer, I can't lose him too.
Sawyer's not dead.
No. But he's gone. Good night, Jack.
Kate. If we're gonna be safe, if we're gonna protect the people that we left behind, tomorrow morning I'm gonna have to convince everyone to lie. If it's just me, they're never gonna go for it. So I'm gonna turn to you first. Are you with me?
I have always been with you.
Except for when I was with Sawyer. You know, there were a few times that I was with Sawyer that I was decidedly not with you. But other than those times, like in the bear cage when you saw that, I've been with you.
Yeah, I mean, there sort of is a duality of the mind thing going on where, like, I've always, at least a part of me has been with you, but some of the more physical parts have been with Sawyer.
She's always had Jack's back, is her point. Like, her point
is, I mean, quite literally, the first thing she did was sew up his back.
You know, like, yes, exactly. And so, like, for Kate, it's like, yeah, there have been times where, like, I'm sorry, like, I don't like you the way you like me, but, like, we have been trying to get out of this situation, and I have almost always backed your play. And, in fact, like, the times that I haven't were because you frosted me out. So I think, like, Kate, you check the record. I do think that, by and large, this holds up. Like, there are going to be holes in the resume for sure. But like vast majority, if we're doing this by like, you know, percentages, I would say like 90% of Lost easily up to this point, Kate has sided with Jack.
And it's also a fun little signifier of, well, that's not going to be the case in the future, right? We saw this with Something Nice Back Home about how they end up splitting up. This, you know, episode is going to be about sort of the Jake coming back together in a way, right? Where despite him leaving her life for a significant portion of time, they're going to end up working together as sort of, you know, unorthodox allies for a good portion of this episode. But also this whole, like, I have always been with you stuff, I don't know, it's very endgamey to me as well. I could imagine, especially with them going with the Juliet Sawyer route, that they wanted to end with Jake stuff no matter what. And this very much feels like a step in that direction of Kate really, you know, telling Jack, like, this to me is going to really call forward to, like, when she kisses him on the rocks, right? Yeah. Before he ends up dying. Like, this is very much her really stamping that approval to say, yeah, I've always got your back no matter what. Even though we're going to have some rocky roads ahead of us, it's going to be a fairly smoothed out pavement by the end of it all.
Yeah. I really like this scene. One thing that I don't really care for is when Kate's like, we got to, like, after everybody that we've lost, Michael, Jin, and Sawyer. You started with Michael. Yeah. Like, you barely knew that Michael was on the thing.
Maybe it was top of mind because she was so shocked to just see him. I thought you would more
so take...
I think,
so like, the show is, like, trying to, like, remind us that, like, Michael and Jin blew up in the freighter so that when Jin shows up at the end of the episode, it's a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, maybe. And we did get the callback to it and the whole entire scene play out a couple episodes ago, but that was 2 weeks ago. I thought you would more so take umbrage with a part of the lie that I have never been a fan with, which is her saying, like, all right, I think we're going to have to say that Aaron is mine in order to protect him. Because, I mean, we saw this in the, you know, the faux documentary about unraveling the Oceanic Six conspiracy. Like, there are so many holes in Kate's story of her claiming, yep, I was 6 months pregnant when I got arrested and went on the plane. I'm just trying to think of, like, it's obvious that Kate has wants to protect Aaron. And I think also by proxy, like, the legacy of Claire moving forward. I'm just wondering if this was too far of a point to leap to say, like, okay, I'm going to protect Aaron by just completely fabricating, obfuscating Claire from the story altogether and saying that he's my son.
Mm, that's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, I think that there's a degree to which it is a fast jump. It's a fast jump to, like, we can't give up Aaron. I'm going to say I'm his mother. And I think, like, there is, like, a degree to which, like, probably, like, kind of, like she's trying to protect Claire. She's trying to protect everybody who's left behind. She cares about Aaron to the extent that she cares about Aaron. But I do also think that there's probably a degree to which this is like, they're not going to arrest me if I'm a mom, right?
Mothers kill on the witness stand.
You know, there might be a little bit of that.
Yeah, though I don't know, because again, her attitude in Eggtown, right, is like, I deserve penance for my crimes, almost. So it's an interesting attitude to have. What I will say, though, is while your mileage may vary about the story beat to have Kate as a mother, I think Evangeline Lilly really does her damnedest to sell Kate as a mother. And I mean, it's going to lead to, in my opinion, might be one of my favorite Kate scenes when she ends up saying goodbye to Aaron later on.
Again, I talk about that a lot. Like, I think that is Evangeline Lilly's best acting moment in the whole series.
Yeah. And so this episode is, again, really laying that foundation, the reappearance of Carol Littleton in her life and sort of like a reminder internally and externally about how he was never really yours to begin with. I just find it interesting that Kate feels like she not only has to take responsibility for the child, right? Because, like, what is the foundational difference between, oh, there was this pregnant woman on board, she gave birth and then died and then sort of, like, gave the child to me, versus this is my kid and nobody else on board gave birth. And this kid is mine, even though you might have seen me beforehand. And I definitely did not look 6 months pregnant. Absolutely right. Not.
Yeah. And Jack is like, no one's really going to check. Like, as a doctor, he's like, I don't know that this is going to work, Kate. She's like, trust me, I got this. All right. 3 years later, Kate is at the hotel room with Sun. She's trying on clothes on loan from Sun. She looks great. Power mm-hmm. suit.
Erin is eating a nice hearty breakfast of what looks like scrambled eggs fries.
Yeah, scrambled eggs and French fries. There's like a fruit salad nearby. Yeah, he needs some help with the ketchup.
He's waving around that little tiny bottle of Heinz ketchup that I feel like was all the rage back in like the late 2000s.
The little tiny Heinz bottle is a classic. It's a hotel classic, I feel like, is that tiny little Heinz ketchup.
And so it's a little bit of a familiar beat, Josh, because again, a little bit of a callback to like season one, season two.
Yes.
Son is Erin's babysitter, much like he was for a good portion of seasons two and three.
I was thinking something very similar. I was thinking of what it reminded me of is when Michael dropped Walt off with Son.
Mm-hmm.
And she like teaches him like what the toothpaste of the island is. Chia. So I like that, but this is like a darker thing. Spoiler alert for the MVP LVPs. I'm giving Sun an LVP this week. She's gonna try and assassinate Benjamin Linus. Like, that's her plan. She's got a box full of chocolates and a gun. I know that Forrest Gump said life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get. But Sun Quan says, I know what you're going to get. You're going to get a handgun underneath the top layer of chocolate that I shall use to pursue Benjamin Linus.
Mm-hmm.
And I will also bring this child who I am babysitting with along for the ride. That is very dangerous. There's some significant reckless endangerment of this child.
Yeah, I mean, Forrest Gump, G-U-N-P.
You really don't want to be a patron of Post Show Recaps to support these incredible gems.
To support the best pun I've ever created, Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. That's patreon.com/postshowrecaps. And if you sign up and you say Forrest Gump, I don't know. We'll make something unique and special happen for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Sign up, patreon.com/postshowrecaps, Forrest Gump. Use that to unlock something as yet to be determined. Maybe
this
front row seat to Mike Bloom's French class.
Oh, yeah, this is very Losty, though, right? We're saying, like, this is important. It might mean something down the line. And we will answer that question.
We'll deliver.
Yeah, I've never liked this, the Forrest Gump of it all. I love Badass Son. I talked about this at the end of season four, that this might be some of Yeonjun Kim's best work. This seems a little too OTT for me. Maybe it's just like, maybe it's a little too Jason Bourne-like for me. I feel like we already have that box ticked with Said. I don't know if we need like the chocolates for you, madam. Check at the bottom, wink, wink. And it's, you know, this fully loaded gun. It's I don't know. It's an odd way to see Sun. We saw her, I think, being more of a power broker in that regard when it came to like the Widmore stuff. I don't know if we need her to be like, undercover assassin Sun.
They just
moment.
Don't
assassin.
Really. They don't really go. Oh my god, they don't really. You're on fire. They don't really go here enough for me. So like, you know, I think like they just don't quite go here enough. And so like Sun having the gun and then like bringing Erin along, I just don't love it. I also did want to know, is this like, does this seem like a meal that Erin at this age would be eating? Asher Bloom probably about a year away from Erin at this point in the show.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Asher at his age already, like, he loves fries.
Okay.
He can give or take eggs depending on what the day is, especially the way my father-in-law makes them, like very cheesy scrambled eggs. So I think this makes sense for like,
he likes that or doesn't like that?
He likes it. So I think that this is very much in line with like the
I was like, were you getting on here and like dragging the way that your father-in-law makes scrambled eggs?
No, absolutely not. Listen, yeah. I mean, this is not what this podcast is for.
Yeah.
To drag my father-in-law's cooking techniques. Yeah. But I think that's within a 3-year-old's palate. The fruit salad, I'm not entirely sure.
He doesn't
sure
seem
of.
To be touching it, though.
Yeah, I think that's more of a son thing. Though,
it's decorative.
Knowing son, there's probably a grenade at the bottom of the fruit bowl or something.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so Kate's going to go. Son gets the dossier with the pictures of Ben and Jack, and she gets the box of chocolates. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Meanwhile, back on the island, Faraday's trying to figure out what's going on with Charlotte. Juliet is asking Faraday some questions about, we're just picking up immediately where we left off with Jughead. Sawyer is like tweaking out. Juliet tells James to take a hike. Juliet with James already is excellent. The Sawyer and Juliet stuff is already so good, I gotta say.
Yeah, and I think now the relationship's going to take a different turn here, where I think he's going to become vulnerable with her. We know this with Sawyer, that I think he only really opens up to probably his closest confidants, or like, you mean something to Sawyer if you're becoming vulnerable about these things. And yeah, this is sort of like the mood we have gotten the past, since season 5 began, which is Sawyer the hothead versus Mrs. Freeze herself, Juliet, once married to Santa Claus in an alternate universe, basically saying like, hey, take 10. Why don't you go talk with Locke? You're going to have some very meaningful conversations.
What Sawyer doesn't have a ton of people, though, right now, right? Like, you know, he's...
Everything he ever loved was on that boat.
You know, Charlotte's dying. Faraday is like... Faraday was cagey. Get it? Because Faraday cage.
But also Faraday is being very cagey. I will say something I don't love about this episode is I feel like we dip a little too much into the trope of... somebody sees or knows something and doesn't tell anybody else. Like, I'm glad we're about to get into his explanation. I'm glad Juliet forces this explanation out of Faraday after we've had Charlotte keep asking him and he doesn't respond. Sawyer's going to be asked later, like, what did you see? He's not going to say anything for a while. Locke is going to be asked what he sees. He doesn't say anything for a while. It all comes out in the wash, but it's one of those tropes I'm not such a big fan of.
Totally. I get that. I absolutely get that. And he's got Locke and Juliet. Those are really like, he doesn't know Miles yet. If he knew Miles better, like, they'd probably be able to like talk more. But like, he knows Locke decently well, but their relationship is always a little tenuous, but like, he could talk to Locke like an adult, and Juliet is the one that he could talk to like an adult the most. So like, I think like just by default, these two people like through like, you know, like trauma, like trauma is what bound all of the survivors of Oceanic 815. And then like this trauma within that trauma is what's binding Sawyer and Juliet together.
Trauma nesting dolls.
Indeed. The trauma initiative. Locke is watching from afar. Sawyer goes and stands with him as Juliet, now being alone with Faraday, they can like kind of talk doctor to doctor. We get to find out what's going on here. Let's take a listen.
Did you know that this would happen?
Thought it might. I think it's neurological. Our brains have an internal clock, a sense of time. The flashes throw the clock off. It's like a really bad jet lag.
Really bad jet lag doesn't make you hemorrhage, Daniel. You want to tell me why it isn't happening to the rest of us?
I don't know. Thank God it's not.
So, yeah, let's talk about this time sickness stuff, because it officially gets, not coined, but mentioned in this conversation. And I think this is, like you mentioned before, one of the more high-stakes elements of the first part of the season. That ultimately, I don't think, I wouldn't say plays as well, but I think it's less high stakes than we initially think when we find out about all this, right? Because I think the circumstances, the assumption is, oh man, now it's a ticking clock, like everyone's going to die. At the end of the day, it kills Charlotte, and this is how we find out a bit about, you know, that Miles might be from the island. But we're only a few episodes away from them being stuck in one time period. And so it's a conflict, I think, to hold us over for a few episodes.
Yeah, but I don't think that makes it bad. I think that that's actually good that... And first of all, someone does die from this. You know?
That's true, but it's Charlotte.
Oh, come on. I mean, yeah, so it's Charlotte, but, like, somebody does die. Like, this, we lose a character through these means. So it's not, like, an empty threat. They do carry through. And I think that it lends urgency to the mission to reach the orchid and reset the wheel quickly. Otherwise, these people are screwed. And it feels like a fast-paced thing because Miles is starting to get it, and then Juliet is starting to get it, and so that is dangerous. That is really, really scary. Who else could it possibly get? As we're getting deeper into what's going on here, so I think it works for me. I don't think it needs to be like long-term payoff for it to be a successful threat. I think it just needs to last us a mini arc, which is effectively what it does. I think it sections off this period of season 5 of Lost in an effective way for me.
Yeah, I think you brought up a great point that it's, you know, it's almost like in comic books, right? You have like mini arcs of 3 to 4 episodes and like a big bad within that. This is sort of the big bad of that arc is like, okay, they're dealing with now the ticking clock of this possible sickness. Let me ask on top of that, though, I guess maybe we can reserve the answer for next week when Charlotte dies. Is it cleaner to kill her off here at the beginning of this episode? Rather than have her, you know, go through this episode and then go through next episode and then die.
That's interesting. I don't know. I kind of feel like I think it's okay to push it a little bit further. I think like if she dies here, then Faraday is a mess because of where they've like sort of like put Faraday and Charlotte at this point. He is going to be a wreck once she does die. So I think like right now, having it that like Faraday is very incentivized to resolve this as quickly as possible is important to like probably some degree to like put the stress on the science guy. They need the science guy. And if the science guy is like under duress, but is also incentivized to resolve this, I think that that adds to the urgency. And then once it becomes clear that she's not going to make it as they're getting closer, I think structurally it makes sense that he's like, he can't keep going, so you're all on your own as you're a little bit closer to the goal. I think they're just a little too far away from the goal right now for Charlotte to die. All of this being said, I hate that it's like that Charlotte's imminent death is what's fueling Daniel. I think that that's weak, but that is the circumstance. So if like the question is like, given that, accept that as a premise that Charlotte's imminent demise is what's motivating Daniel, should she die now or should she die later? I choose die later.
Right, and that's the thing is that like if there is a universe, though, where I think it's fine that she dies. He's still concerned because he's looking around at everybody being like, well, we're going to die. We're going to end up just like her. And maybe then you sort of undo the woman I'm in love with is in this room right now. And I want to blow up the island with her. If you make it less about like Daniel specifically working to cause Charlotte to live, though I guess that also talks about the Teresa Spencer stuff a bit. Yes. I don't know. I think we'll have more time to address the situation, I think, next week once Charlotte expires. But after watching this, specifically the way Jughead ends into like how all of this begins, it just got me thinking of, okay, Charlotte's going to have sort of like a death scare now and then is actually going to kick the bucket next episode. Was that delay really needed? I think you bring up some interesting points, though, about how in terms of the plotting, we weren't completely there to have her maybe die at this moment.
No, not quite. All right, let's go off island. Kate is gonna meet with Mr. Norton, who was a history teacher of mine once upon a time. Not this same Norton. Kate's gonna go and meet with the lawyer, and she's come to make a deal.
I will say, just before we play, that you bring up the lawyer makes me think of Jurassic Park, and he's about to, like, snatch
the blood-sucking lawyer! Yeah, oh my god, if only. Anyway, play it.
Thank you for waiting. Did my assistant offer you something to drink?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you.
Good, please, Ms. Austin, sit.
So,
how can I help you?
Mr. Norton, when you came to my house looking for blood samples for me and my son, I asked you who your client was.
And I said I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. I'm here to offer you a deal. I'll give you the blood samples. But first, I want to talk to your client. OK? Considering what you're asking for, that's more than reasonable.
Well, I am seeing my client later today, and I will be sure to pass along your offer. But I am pretty sure what the answer is going to be. No. And the reason, of course, is that you're in no position to be making any kind of deals, and we both know it. I have a signed court order compelling you to let us confirm that you're the child's mother. I could send the sheriff over there today and make you do it, but my client insists that we handle the exchange of custody quietly.
What do you mean, exchange of custody?
You know exactly what I mean.
No. Mr. Norton, I just want to know who is doing this to me.
You did this to yourself. Now it is time you prepare yourself, Ms. Austin. You are going to lose the boy.
Dan Norton sucks.
Dan Norton sucks.
Not only does he suck,
Dan Norton sucks.
He's wrong.
Yeah.
So here's what I looked up, and I would love for any legal experts out there. I'm sending out like a psychic signal
right now. Behind the curtain, you know?
Yeah.
Let us know.
But this is what Lostpedia says. Lostpedia says the legal situation Kate finds herself in is not actually possible. There is no provision for privacy when compelling a blood sample from anyone or for any reason. Attorney-client privileges does not extend to this. Also, if Erin were to be removed from her custody, she would have every legal right as the child's guardian, if not mother, to know the person or persons taking her child. So essentially, all this, like, braggadociousness and bloviating that Norton says of like, oh, well, of course I cannot tell you who the person is. Can you not? They're not going to say it anyway. You have no case here.
Is Dan Norton, like, one of the ogres from Fraggle Rock?
That's me. I'm Dan Norton. Come on, you Kate Austin Fraggle. I'm going to eat you. Come on, Sprocket. What was the names of those guys?
Oh, God. What were they? I'm staring at like a Fraggle Rock.
Not the Dozers. Fraggle Rock. What were they called? Let's do a quick.
Let's do a quick rock.
We got the Dozers.
Yeah, these were like the human-sized Muppets for people who might remember.
Uh-huh. Setting. The Gorgs.
Gorgs. Right? That's what it was. Yeah.
The Gorgs. Yeah. Is Dan Norton a Gorg?
I mean, listen, he is monstrous in many capacities.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate this guy.
He has like a flair for the dramatic as well, right? Like, nobody's gonna be like, I'm facing Miss Austin, like, you're gonna give the child to us. It's so OTT. But of course, now it all makes sense that, of course, Ben Linus would hire this guy,
yeah.
Right? Because, like, not only is he scummy, but he also can, like, play with people. And that feels right out of Ben's wheelhouse.
Yeah. He was Claire Danes' dad in My So-Called Life. He's a scumbag on The Morning Show. Tom Irwin is the name of the actor. Dan Norton on Lost. He's Gorg. He's a bad dude. Don't like this guy. All right. So that's what's going on with Dan Norton trying to just like break the law. To be fair,
Kate, and maybe this is also, doesn't help that Kate doesn't have her lawyer present as well. Duncan's treasure chest is not, open at the moment.
Right. Because the lawyer would just be like, this isn't real.
Yeah, he'd be like, no, I'm going to call BS on your argument right now, Ogre Norton.
You can't do this. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think
right now,
Kate,
you can do.
Yeah, I think Kate's falling for it a little bit right now. Like, you see her eyes grow wide when Norton just mentions the idea exchange of custody. Because, again, if we're talking about the fragility of the lie falling apart, this is sort of like Kate's stakes in it, right?
Yeah.
Like, she wanted to move forward. Erin was sort of what she wanted to hold on to, and now she's losing possession of it. The House of Cards is collapsing, and that is a big deal for her. That match has kind of already been struck when she saw Claire, quote-unquote Claire, holding Erin in There's No Place Like Home, but now the fuse is starting to run down a bit, and that, from her perspective, it does seem like legitimately someone is coming for Erin.
Yeah, someone is coming for Erin, indeed, and she's freaked out, rightfully so. Back on the island, John Locke has come up with a plan. While he and Sawyer are still just sort of like on the outskirts, they're on the sidelines watching Faraday and Juliet with Charlotte. They get to talking, John and James, and Locke brings up an idea that I think is really worth talking to as we are talking. And I don't think that we've given like enough credit to the fact that like we are talking through John Locke's final mortal arc right now.
On Island specifically, too. Like these are his final moments before he leaves the island forever.
Like, on Island, sure, of his life. He is at the end of his life right now. And we just really, I do feel like, let's stress that. This is John Locke is at the end of his life right now. And we haven't really talked about it from that standpoint. And I think that John Locke is now about to talk about it from that standpoint. Let's listen in.
We have to go back to the orchid.
Excuse me?
The orchid. That's where all this started. Maybe it's where it'll all stop.
The greenhouse is a long ways away.
You said you had a Zodiac raft back at the beach. We could take that, cut around the horn of the island and get the orchid in half the time.
And let me guess, you know exactly what to do when we get there.
Not exactly at all, but I know that Ben used it to leave the island, and if I can do the same thing, I believe I can save us.
And how are you going to do that?
This is all happening because they left. I think it'll stop if I can bring them back.
Bring who back?
Jack, Son, Saeed, Hugo, Kate.
The boat blew up and that chopper was probably on it.
They're not dead, James.
Says who?
That doesn't matter. All that matters is they've got to come back. I have to make them come back. Even if it kills me. Don't you want them to come back, James? Don't you want her to come back?
Doesn't matter what I want.
So, I think it bears repeating. This is a pretty big John Locke episode, because I know we had some stuff with Richard Alpert and Jughead that we really liked that we talked about last week. But Josh, this episode to me is really the first time since Because You Left where John Locke is taking, like, fully digesting what Richard Alpert of the future told him.
Right.
Which is you have to go bring everybody back, but you're going to have to die to do it.
So much has happened that, like, we haven't even really had a moment to process it. So, like, you got to, like, thank John Locke in this moment for, like, bringing it back up. Because you're like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. That's a big deal. He was told that he has to die. And so this is, like, Locke is, like, processing it. He is seeing the severity of the time skips. He is seeing what's going to happen to them. Literally, if they do not solve this problem, they will die. They can't just, like, stand around and wait it out. They'll die. Time sickness is coming for them. And Locke, who's, you know, the guy who's always like waiting for signs, but is also like, you know, before all this started, was ready to become the leader of the others, the protector of the island. He may not be the leader of the others, but he still views himself as the protector of the island in this moment. And so he is like taking this beat to put an action plan together. And it's starting to like click into place for himself where he's like, I have to die to save us. I have to leave. I'm not going to make it. I may not make it, but I think I can save us. I think Richard Alpert was right. And he's starting to develop, you know, something akin to this plan. I think he's obviously we're going to see it that like he's going to try very hard not to die. And I think when he does die and when he's making the choice to end his life. He's not doing it like he's not excited about it, to say the least.
He's not like, well, I did that part of the plan. Check off part A. Part B, guess I'm going to have to die now. No, it's out of like pure misery.
Yes.
About what he was not able
it's not
to
working.
Do, at least in the
It's
moment.
Not working. It's not working is what he's thinking. Yeah. But like here he is in this moment. He's like, I will do what has to be done. And I think this is what has to be done. It is a really powerful, bold moment from John Locke. It's a great John Locke episode. He's like really dogged right now.
And not to mention, it's so odd to compare, but it's almost like Locke's greatest hits, in a manner of speaking, this episode, right? He's going to be able to visit a seminal part of his life on the island, if not a seminal part of his life. He's going to have, I think, his own sort of reconciling, which we will listen to later on, of him basically reasoning with Sawyer, like, my life was shit, but it made me the person that I am today, so I'm grateful for it all the same. Like, it's a real reckoning with John Locke. He doesn't exactly know when he's going to die, but he essentially had this thick eyelash Desmond tell him you're going to have to die at some point for this to happen.
Right.
And so I think Locke is now finally, he doesn't know the when, he doesn't know the how, he knows the why.
Right.
And I think the why is what's been pushing John Locke this entire time, and it's going to continue to push him here. So I really like his arc in this episode. It's small. Like you said, you would imagine that, like, on paper, if it's okay, John Locke makes the decision to leave the island and to die in the process, you would think that'd be a much bigger deal than it's probably made out to be. But I almost like its subtlety. Maybe it's just because we also have so much other John Locke bananas aspects throughout season five that I'm good for a little bit of, like, underplayed stuff when it comes to his major decisions.
Yeah, but I also think structurally this is good, like, because, like, the Locke that you get, or the Terry O'Quinn that you get for the majority of the season, or, like, the second half of the season, rather, is, like, such a confident, quote-unquote, John Locke, that I think, like, you need sort of, like, Locke in his final stretch here on the island, at least, to at least appear to be this determined and this brave and this, like, decisive, because that's going to, like, match who he is when he comes back, and, like, you as a viewer on first blush, you're like, oh, it worked, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's connecting those two versions of the character, even though we know, with the benefit of hindsight, that it's a different guy.
It's a fake.
So Charlotte's going to wake up. She doesn't recognize Daniel immediately, and then she starts feeling dizzy, but mostly fine. They're now trying to figure out, okay, well, what do we do? And Sawyer's the one who goes, I'll tell you now what. We're going to the Orchid. I don't know why I became Saul Drillman all of a sudden. Yeah,
oh, my God. Yeah. That's the big twist.
Yeah. You come to the Orchid. I'm down here still. I'm still drilling. Come say hi. Yeah. I haven't left.
Is this like how, like, George Joseph Gordon-Levitt becomes Bruce Willis in Looper? Like, eventually Sawyer becomes Saul Drillman?
Yeah, yeah. Can you believe that? Time travel. Well, if you can't believe it, come on down to the Orchid. I'll drill down into a pocket of time travel. I'll show you what's going on.
Here's the big twist. I've been recruited to drill a hole in your head, even though you're the older me.
Yeah, come on down, Sawyer. It's me. You. I'm Saul Drillman. So are you. Come on down to the Orchid. I'll show you how to time travel. All right, back off the island. Jack and Saeed. Saeed has been unconscious for over 42 hours. He had 3 doses of tranquilizer in his system, and he is still going to be able-bodied enough to combat an assassin.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is like Saeed working everything through his system. He sort of is mostly dead, a la, you know, Princess Bride. Jack's trying to pump him through stuff as much as possible. And they're trying to also, like, catch each other up on what's going on. But it's going to be broken up by Dr. Ariza, the rare source of sanity here, who's pulling Jack aside and is like, You can't be here. You're not allowed in this building,
You've
Jack.
Been suspended.
Because you were popping pills and yelling about your dead dad.
You've been suspended. You should not be here. And he's like, oh, sorry. I don't know what to tell you. I'm here.
Sorry.
So she's like, get out of here. And meanwhile, we are going to cut back. Oh, he's going to get the call from Hurley first.
Yeah.
He gets the call from Hurley. Hurley's like, dude, I'm in LA County lockup. It's great. See ya.
I'm a little surprised that Dr. Ariza just doesn't immediately kick Jack out of the hospital, right? You know what? I'll let you take your phone call first. Yeah. That's fine. She's reasonable, I guess, in that regard. But yeah, we get this fun little checkup on Hurley, right, where he threw himself willingly in front of the police at the end of the lie. Now he's in lockup. He is cool as a cucumber and is basically like, I'm great, man. Ben's never going to get to me, so tell Saeed thanks.
Yeah. Again, like, to this idea of what I love about this episode, it's like this is like the perfect use of Hurley in this moment. So we have like Hurley fully located. We know exactly
Hurley
where
fully loaded.
You know, we know exactly where this man is, and so like he's a stable element throughout the rest of, like, he's stable in his instability. The fact that he's in prison, how do we get him out of there? Is, you know, worth pondering. But we can account for him, and then he is used for like a great comedic, chaotic effect, where he, like, in the middle of all of like this like swirling mayhem that is occurring, Jack gets the phone call from Hurley, like, yeah, I'm fine, I'm in LA County lockup, it's great, see ya. And Jack's like, wait, Hurley? And like, then the phone call's been burned, and so it's just a great little check-in with this character. Like, I feel like just about everybody gets a moment in this episode. It's really fun.
Yeah, and I don't think we necessarily need any more stuff, right?
We don't.
Like,
no,
like,
it's perfect.
Because the
perfect
line
amount.
Was this big Hurley episode. We don't necessarily need more of him. We're going to get more of him, obviously, in the next couple episodes. So I just love this little check-in, too.
It's great.
Like you said, it's the instable stability of, like, this is the best they've ever felt. Also, I'm incarcerated.
Yes,
bye.
It's hysterical. Ben's going to show up just in time for Saeed to take down this assassin who's coming undercover as a nurse.
Yeah, what's the deal with this? Did Widmore, like, fabricate, a hospital ID for this guy? Has this guy just always been a nurse and was, like, undercover for that long of a time until one of the Oceanic Six came into the hospital?
I don't think that we have we have no ground to stand on regarding this hospital being a beacon of security, considering that Jack was able to just, like, ferret Saeed into here, even though he's been, like, ruthlessly
Even though he's been suspended and nobody know, like, Jack Shepard, imagine this guy who got suspended for substance abuse is, like, the bodyguard style, hauling this unconscious man into the hospital bed.
No,
like, all right, I need a bed and a bunch of adrenaline. I think Saint Sebastian just lets a lot of things slide here.
Yes. So no good. No good. So he's going to be able to trank out this guy. Meanwhile, Ben and Jack walk in. Saeed mistrustful of Ben, of course. As they search this man's unconscious bodys, I guess it's just the one, they find Kate's address is in his pocket. Is this just because Widmore is trying to round up the candidates at this point? Can we feel pretty safe that that's what's going on?
Or could this have been someone that Ben hired?
Right. That's the other possibility, that this is a guy who is going to go and pick up Kate, is going to pick up Saeed, that Ben's plan may well be, let me tranquilize the candidates and get them on an airplane.
I mean, that's going to happen with Saeed, does it not, when it comes to 316, actually?
Right.
We're going to find out later on this episode that, like, Ben has machinations going on behind these scenes to, like, almost emotionally manipulate people to get on the plane. Maybe he has the capacity to physically manipulate people as well, of, like, oh, we'll pretend it's from Widmore to convince Saeed that his life is in danger, and so that's why he must go back to the island.
Correct. So there's a lot going on. Good on Saeed, though, with three doses of tranquilizer in his system to take this guy down.
Firm return to Saeed mode. Unfortunately, we'll only get a few more times at this, but man, is it fun. I love the shot of this guy, going for the trank darts and then, like, turning around and he's gone. And Saeed just, like, completely takes him down with the cord around his neck.
Yeah, it's good. Jack is going to call Kate. And she picks up, given everything, she still picks up. And he's
then she immediately says, like, I wish I hadn't, but I'll meet with you.
Yeah, so she's going to meet with Jack. Saeed and Ben are going to be paired up. We're running out of time, is what Ben tells Jack, as if he is Jack Bauer, the star of 24, the focus of Worst Day Ever, a new podcast here on Post Show Recaps, where we are recapping season one of 24. Check it out, Worst Day Ever, 24 podcast, happening here on Post Show Recaps. It's real, it's happening.
Yeah, we go back to 2004 in this episode, and you're going back to 2004 when's 24?
It's 2001. 2001.
2001, okay.
Even earlier. All right, back on the island, Sawyer and Locke are walking, talking, James is going to ask John, what are you going to say to Kate to get her to come back? She was pretty excited to get out of here. Meanwhile, they're going to flash through time. It's now nighttime. Locke knows when they are because he sees the Desmond light beaming up from out of the hatch. And he is, like, insistent. He's like, don't everybody get out of here. Nobody be here.
Though I think this is they definitely, I think, dramatize this after the fact. Because I don't think the Desmond spotlight was, like, a movie premiere spotlight, that you see from miles and miles away. As Locke said one time, it was probably just Desmond going to the bathroom. But I do love the image of it as well. And maybe this is Locke being like, let's avoid running into ourselves. Maybe it's just Locke saying, like, let's not deter from the mission. I'm not entirely sure, but he very clearly knows when they are, and so is Sawyer in a few minutes.
He's gonna make clear why he didn't want to go there pretty soon.
Why he personally didn't want to go
there. Yes. So we'll check in with that. I do think it's great that in this moment there are two John Locks.
We are
getting to a place where this season is about two John Locks. So just another clue along the way of the smoke monster twist that this season is building towards.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Charlotte's headache is being distracted by her sore feet. Miles' nose is going to start bleeding. He's asked, "How are you doing?" And he says, "I'm Peachy." I thought he was Miles, not Peachy. No,
that's his middle name, Miles Peachy Strom.
Mm-hmm.
That's his nickname on the Dharma League Little League team.
Yeah, could we get it to stick calling Miles Peachy?
Listen, I'm going to call him anything because Miles is really getting on my nerves, Josh.
Is it happening now or is it happening later? I'm trying to figure out because this did not stand out to me as a really bad Miles episode.
I think it's just every time they cut to him, he has some wise ass remark that isn't working for me. As Hurley talked about in season four, right? We already have a Sawyer. To me right now, I'm starting to realize that it's feeling a little redundant for me to have, especially to have Sawyer with Miles. It just feels it's like having, version 2.0 next to version 1.0. I know that in this case, version 2.0 could arguably be better than version 1.0, but it's we don't need, we don't need to go out and get Sawyer. We already have plenty of Sawyer at home. I don't know if we necessarily need Miles, especially because Miles is still sort of in Sawyer season one mode. And we already have, the smarminess of Sawyer Season 5 combined with all this delicious character arc that I don't know if we need a retrograde Sawyer, saying all these little, one-liners, being a little bit of an a-hole in these moments of, high climaticism. It just feels like it's not necessary at this moment to have both of these characters when Miles hasn't really been developed yet. And, for some strange reason, none of his lines worked for me in this episode.
Okay, fair enough. I think that's fair. There have been times where Miles has really not worked for me. I've warmed up to him as a character, but that has taken me multiple rewatches to feel good about Miles as a character. But I definitely connect with what you're saying, that I think especially because Sawyer is of such a specific energy and does it so well, Josh Holloway, that you have to make some space to make room for Miles potentially.
And there is no room. Exactly. There'll be more room in the 70s when they're sort of separate and doing their things. Right now they're part of the same group, and it's Miles is almost the little brother trying to take on Sawyer's mannerisms, thinking that they're cool, and it just isn't working for me. I apologize, Jessica Lease. But Miles is not working for me necessarily on this watch. I'm excited to get to later on in season 5 and especially season 6, where I think I'm going to warm up to him a little bit more.
So we're not playing the sound here because I think a lot of it is the crying and the screaming, but the music is so beautiful here as Sawyer is going to come across Kate and Claire in the jungle as Claire is giving birth to Aaron. It is wild to me still that Sawyer was a witness to this. I think just adds to that the power of this moment. It's great. It's really, really, really lovely.
And it's also a rare connection between on island and off island stuff too, because again, off island, it's the safety of Aaron is at top of mind for Kate. And here is the birth of Aaron. It also connects back to the very first scene that we listened to when Kate reminds Jack of, like, did you know that Claire wanted to give Aaron up? Claire's going to repeat this to Kate. And I'll just admit, for me, like, it's just a great reminder of, like, that truly incredible episode that was Do No Harm, and how the birth of Aaron just, like, absolutely made me sob when we watched it this time back. And now, specifically watching Josh Holloway's reaction to this scene is so interesting, because there's a lot about this, right? It's not necessarily about Claire, though I think, you know, there probably is still some residual guilt about the fact that maybe he felt like Claire got away on his watch when it was him and Miles in the middle of the jungle at the end of season four. Remember, that only happened a couple of days ago, technically speaking. But I think that there is some sort of, like, proto-closure right now where he is seeing Kate. And I think for the first time in a while, this arguably happened a bit with the breakdown at the hatch door, but I think this is one of the first times that Sawyer is specifically reconciling with the loss of Kate.
Yeah.
With him believing, as he mentioned before, he thinks that she's gone. Whether that means gone on a chopper, or probably more likely from his thinking, blown up in the freighter. And now he is seeing someone who meant so much to him, and he's seeing a past version of her. And there's so much, like, so many complicated emotions swirling behind his eyes, right? He's going to talk to Locke about, I'm sure he was questioning himself, like, can I go see her? He's going to tell Juliet later, like, I was close enough to touch her. Right. And I'm sure that was a thought that really dabbled across his mind as he was doing this. Like, not only is it the trippiness of stumbling across this big moment from the past of time travel, but also the emotional resonance of, this is someone I thought I never would see again. I do now, but can I or should I do anything about it? We face this actually all the time in pop culture, especially in sci-fi, right? Like, a character dies, you travel back in time and you meet a previous version of that character. Like, do you do anything about it? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And I think Sawyer's going through that dilemma right now.
Yeah, I think that versions of that are what's happening. Josh Holloway is such a good actor, so underrated. The way, like, when they flash back and, like, Locke comes up to him, did you see something out here, James? And, like, Josh Holloway is just playing it like he's so shell-shocked. Like, he's just, like he's just been through a true trauma, which he has. You know, he thinks that she's dead. He thinks that she's gone. And there she was right there. And he got to see her again. He saw a ghost. Is not unlike how this plays and what this really is for James Sawyer Ford. And when he says it doesn't matter, it's gone now. It's just a really, really, really powerful moment. This episode is filled with stuff like this. I think that this is a stronger episode than it gets credit for.
I agree. I think that there is a lot that's forgotten about it on the surface, but I think, you know, you're looking at each tree in that forest and there's, like, some real pretty bark going on, some very nice leaves.
That Forrest Gump. So many forests. Forrest Whitaker, Forrest Gump.
Oh yeah, Forrest Whitaker's still around. I wonder if he's hopping around time with everybody.
Yes.
Maybe he's in the other Outrigger.
Perhaps. So with Jack and Kate, Jack shows up. He, like, goes and sits, kneels beside Kate's window. It's a cute moment between the two of them where Kate's like, you shaved your beard. And he goes, yeah, I just needed a change. I really love that line from Matthew Fox.
It's a really interesting sequence, and we're going to get into it in a little bit, where, like, Jack and Kate are almost like partners in crime here, right? Where, like, despite everything that happened with them, as Kate said, she has Jack's back, and in this case, he's going to have hers, where he meets up with her, where she's, like, staking out, essentially, Dan Norton's car, and is like, okay, you know, I'm going to drive, you better get in, or, like, you know, shit or get out the pot, essentially, like that blood-sucking lawyer. And Jack's going to get in the driver's seat or passenger seat alongside her and, like, go along with her, which, again, I think shows, at least in this moment, Jack is reciprocating what Kate told him back on The Searcher.
Yeah. So she's in pursuit of the lawyer, the blood-sucking lawyer. She wants to know what his deal is. She's going to try and follow him. She tells Jack, like, get in or get out. He's like, I'm getting in. Coming in. So he's going to hop in the car, going to get in the backseat, let Kate drive. Meanwhile, on the island, another great Locke and Sawyer scene as they are going to post-mortem the most recent flash. Let's listen in.
Hey, you ready to tell me who you saw back there?
I already told you it was nothing.
You and I both know when we were before the flash, James. So who was it you saw? Charlie? Shannon? Yourself?
How is it that you knew when we were, Johnny boy? That light in the sky was from the hatch, wasn't it?
The night that Boone died, I went out there and started pounding on it as hard as I could. I was confused, scared, babbling like an idiot, asking why was all this happening to me.
Did you get an answer?
Light came on, shot up into the sky. At the time, I thought it meant something.
Did it?
No, it was just the light.
Why'd you turn us around then? Did you want to go back there?
Why would I want to do that?
So you could tell yourself to do things different. Save yourself a world of pain.
No, I needed that pain. Get to where I am now.
So something that was pointed out in the Jim Fells video for this episode that I really like is that underneath that scene is a much more subdued version of Locked Out Again, which is, or Locked Out, whatever the name of the song is, the Deus Ex Machina song.
Right, right.
So essentially, John Locke is reprising his moment of the light shining out of the hatch in a musical form as well. But I think it being played more mellifluously, less grandiose than it did before, is also a representation of like how psychologically John Locke has compartmentalized that moment, right? Where he sort of is like looking back at it almost churlishly of like, oh, I remember back then when I thought that that was a big sign and that the island was shining a light to me. And now he's sort of saying like, oh, how young and naive I was back then. Now I truly know what my purpose is. But I mean, again, this is a big moment for Locke, and it's also some key advice for Sawyer as well. It's not unlike, you know, Bernard giving Jin some big advice in G.E.O.N., where it's like a small scene between two characters, one of whom is going to impart some advice onto the other one. In this case, it's Locke essentially telling Sawyer, like, what's done is done. Pain makes you who you are. Celebrate who you are from the experiences you've been through, no matter how crappy they may be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I feel that deeply. I think that is, it's a very mature, wise place to operate from if you can get there authentically of like, that was all awful, and it was always going to happen, or at least I can't do anything about it. It happened, but where I am now, I'm in a stronger place because I endured that thing. And I think that there is also like, there is another piece to that, which is like, you know, it doesn't mean that any of that was okay or good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is not to like absolve the pain that I went through before. All of that was traumatic and all of that was bad. And by the way, if I wasn't where I am now in like a place where like I feel good about where I am now, that would also be valid, because all of that was terrible and I am entitled to process this for a long period of time. But for John Locke, where he is right now is just like very determinedly moving towards a goal. And he feels like, I think he feels like if he is very much of the mind that everything has happened for a reason. And I think for him, it's even like them leaving and causing this problem happened for a reason. And me leaving here and going to bring them back is the next thing that is going to happen for a reason, so that the next thing after that can happen. Like Locke is following the line. We talked about this, you know, not terribly long ago, but these are the tram lines, right? Like this is him on the rails, and he's following that line. He's the hunter. He's just tracking it. And I think for Sawyer, who his relationship with Locke, I do think is often an understated one, but really a special relationship, I think, in the lexicon of the show. I love the two of them together in these moments and in this episode, especially the ways in which certain characters, specifically John and Juliet, are helping Sawyer like kind of like grow a little bit more in this portion of season five. I think it's really, really, really lovely to behold.
It's weird for me to say, but I almost find Locke's attitude relatable. It's a weird thing to take, because I mean, listen, I, like many people out there, have also tried to compartmentalize like the tragedies or misfortunes that have happened in my life and try to wonder like, okay, was this all for some greater purpose, right? Because that helps you, I think, sort of question the chaos and calamity of, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Why is this happening to me? Again, that sort of is Locke's breakdown in Deus Ex Machina, right? Like, I did everything you told me to, so why is this happening to me? And I think that as long as it's healthy, it's all right to sort of assign yourself purpose. I think the relatability for me takes maybe less from that if everything happens for a reason, but more so this idea of like, I am a compendium of my experiences.
Right.
You know, the way I personally compartmentalize things good and bad that have happened in my life is I personally look at like every single moment I experience as a learning experience of, if something goes wrong, then I have learned something from it. If something good happens, I have learned something from it as well. And you sort of file it away. And I think almost like computationally, you take the decisions and lessons you have learned from all these various nodes, and you sort of file them away to build who you are as a person. I am foundationally someone who has been built on 31 years of mistakes and poor decisions and bad relationships, but also sure. The good stuff as well. And I think that's where I sort of see the reading of this line too, that it's less so like, I needed that pain because, you know, everything had to lead me to this point. Like you said, with the tram line, I think it could also be this idea of like, that pain taught me certain things about life and foundationally built me as this person. Like, there's experiential stuff about that as well that I think is so cool with a character like John Locke, who has been through so much. And another great thing I like about this scene is that even though we had some connection in season four, I don't know, Josh, I got big flashbacks to the brig with this Locke and Sawyer stuff.
Well, I mean, there is a great line in the TV show Justified, "We dug coal together." And like, there is sort of this quality to Locke and Sawyer about like, we both got Anthony Coopered. You know, like, we both went through a very specific trauma that defined our entire lives, perpetrated by the same person. They have been through something that no one can relate to outside of each other. And so I think like, often it leads to like a lot of like the contentiousness between John and James. But there's also like a degree to which like Sawyer is more amenable to Locke's bullshit than Jack is, because I think like he can understand Locke in a way that Jack at least yet can't, and also in a specific way that Jack never will and that no one else ever will, as far as people that they know, because they were both just like ruined by this one same person. So I think that like often like, it gets a little hairy between the two of them, but when they're able to find some common ground, I think a lot of it is born out of like, they were both, they've both like dabbled in the devil's sandbox. Like they dug sand together. Like
nothing but cat poop in those sandboxes.
They know what's going on there. Now you're out on Miles, but I actually really love this moment with Miles. When he's walking with Faraday, he goes, "Hey, so I just got a nosebleed. Let's not freak everybody out here. Let's keep this quiet." As Faraday's like initial reaction, like, "Oh shit!" And Miles is the one who is like, "I understand that this is bad. I don't need to stress out any further than I'm currently stressed. Could you explain to me the why you think this is happening to the two of us?" So I think it's a great Miles moment, which is a little bit why I'm surprised that this is the episode where like you're really not feeling it with Miles, because I think that this is one of my favorite Miles scenes to date. Maybe my favorite Miles scene to date is where he's just like, "Hey, so I just got a nosebleed. Why?"
I think this is a fine scene. Maybe just because when he uses the term Yahoos, that really calls back to Sawyer in the finale. I'm like, you're just trying to be Sawyer. Stop trying to be Sawyer, Miles. I don't think this is fine. I mean, I think the main takeaway from this scene, right, is Faraday planting this idea of like, well, nosebleeds might come from how much time you spent on the island. Miles, where did you come from? And obviously that is going to bear so much more fruit
right
later on. But yeah, I would say this is the best Miles scene of the episode, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly close. I think it's I really do think it might be my favorite Miles scene so far. So they get back to the initial Oceanic 815 camp, except now it is littered. Literally,
yeah, trash in the camp, Tarzan style.
Trash beach. There's a detritus from Ajira 316, which we will see soon. A totally new airline that, like, Sawyer has obviously lived under a rock because he doesn't know what Ajira is, but it's apparently a major airline.
Yeah, again, because Juliet, who has been on this island for 3 years, knows not only them, but, like, their big marketing pitch, right? Which is, we'll fly literally anywhere.
Yeah, they fly everywhere. So they will fly literally anywhere, Ajira. They've got the water bottle, but they're back at camp. And this is a sneak peek at the show's future, not just like where we will get in the 2007 timeline of season 5, but I feel like also sort of like the trashed out beach and sort of this idea of the island as a haunted house takes more shape in season 6. It is one of my it is really high on the list of, like, you know, the relatively short list compared to the rest of the show of the things that I love in season 6 is this sort of haunted mansion quality about the island, of like all of these rooms that used to have life that are now empty and just like riddled with if not literal ghosts, though Miles might freak out if he stays here too long, that definitely have that like sort of spooky energy. You know, Count Jakula would have a field day with the Ajira takeover of Oceanic 815's beach. Like, there's just something like dead about this place. I know that's next week. This place is death.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree. It very much feels like almost like a relic too, but almost like a trash relic where it's not like the pristine camp. Now
it's like this idea of like this thing that we love is almost dead.
Yeah.
It's so close to death.
It's like, just like we were talking about with Locke, right? Yeah. It's a stark reminder of, yeah, we're in the end game now.
It's like this thing is like in a very, very bad way. And we are all going to have to rally very hard to fight tooth and nail to keep this thing alive. I think that the show does a good job of visually conveying the island in that state long before, like, the island literally starts to break apart. So I really do appreciate that about the end game. It's one of my favorite pieces of the end game. It's just sort of like this like hollowed husk of an island that you get, that like it used to be so full of life, the Oceanic Beach, and now this place is death, even though that is next week. So they see the outriggers, they're going to grab one of the outriggers, and I don't know, this is the outrigger scene. I feel like this is the time to like really do the outrigger stuff, where they're going to be on the outrigger, they're getting shot, not shocked. Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse have long said that this is the one thing about Lost that they will never explain. They may explain everything else someday, but one thing that they will never, ever reveal is who was on the other outrigger, because it is not an example of a thing that they did not have an answer to. They say that they very much do have an answer, to the point that the scene was written. These are the words of Damon Lindelof. Damon Lindelof has said, I believe... this is in an interview with Alan Sepinwall, I'm pretty sure, according to the Ben Behind the Curtain. Lindelof says, when we wrote that scene and somebody started shooting at them, we knew exactly who was shooting at them. This is not a dangling thread that we don't know the answer to. But that being said, as we started talking about paying that off this season, it felt like the episode was at the service of closing the time loop as opposed to what the characters might actually be doing in that scenario. And it never felt organic. Carlton Cuse adds that the logistics of getting all the participants in the outriggers in the configuration that was on the A side of the time loop was actually really daunting. Meanwhile, Jorge Garcia has been on the record as saying that a scene explaining the other half of the outrigger chase was in a script for an episode that he saw, but he never found the script, and it never provided the details. So it's unlikely that we are ever going to get like an official answer straight from Lindelof and Cuse, though there are those out there who believe there is a canonical answer to who was on the other outrigger. The Complete Collection DVD provides an answer of sorts, and that answer is apparently that the people on the other outrigger were
members of the Black Rock, the slaver ship that is stranded in the middle of the jungle.
Old Richard Alpert's boat.
Yes, that they themselves were trapped in some kind of time paradox. There is an extract that can be found in the complete collection. It comes directly from a prop that was made to represent the ledger from the Black Rock from Magnus Hanso that Widmore bought at the auction in the Constant. This extract reads, December 18th, I think it's with a question mark, an away team of six men was launched at first light in an attempt to get to the island with hopes of determining our location. Only one returned alive. He seems in a deep shock, muttering about exchanging musket fire with another vessel, which promptly disappeared in a flash of heavenly light. He went on to claim that after hours of traversing the island, his five crewmates simply jumped overboard as if lemmings, and no degree of coaxing could persuade them back into the boat. They drowned. Everyone. There will be no more away teams. So this is according to like a DVD extra. And I think that like you can choose whether or not, you know, your definition of canon and what matters to you and what is the official answer. That definition is going to vary from person to person. Like, I think not at all about the Valenzetti equation, as we've discussed in the past.
We're going to get that mentioned in this episode, right, with all the number stuff.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily think about this as, like, this has to be the answer to the outrigger. My answer to the outrigger is that we will never know, and that Damon and Carlton have said we will never know. That's good enough for me that it's just, like, more timey-wimey-ness that's going on. But this is apparently as close to an official thing as possible, and it's speculated that this scene that explained the other half of the outrigger chase was from Abby Turno, which would have been really interesting to see in the context of that episode, but that episode is already packed. So to get there would be really hard. But Mike, if this is where the scene takes place, if the other outrigger hails from the Black Rock, do you like that? Do you hate it? Are you impartial? Do you care?
I don't really like it.
Uh-huh.
I think it's just because, like, this time travel stuff, as complex as it is rather simple to me. Like, here are our five or six 815ers plus freighters. They're jumping through time. I don't know if I like the added complexity on top of that of, okay, now people from the Black Rock are involved.
Right.
You know, like, now they're sort of on their own separate trail. I don't like convoluting that necessarily, unless, like, oh, did they flash another time? But no, that would make sense, right? They take the outrigger, and then maybe they'd flash back to the time of the Black Rock where they get fired upon, and then they flash again to the 80s. Maybe that would make more sense if there was an additional flash in there. But I think the implication of, okay, now there's a crew from the Black Rock that almost is like Minkowski-ing it right now. They're sort of going through their own stuff, I think is a little needlessly complicated to me. I think I'd rather go with something that Snorri Jonsson actually suggested, which is that maybe, like, you know, simplest explanation, Occam's razor, maybe it's, you know, Widmore's team. Maybe it's like Zoe and some of the mercs that got brought on. We know they're going to be in the ocean with Hydra Island. Maybe there's a chance that they ran into them, they fired upon them, and so, like, they were able to escape them for a time being. They have another Sawyer that they get to deal with in the main timeline, but this was just sort of like, oh, who are these people? Oh, let's shoot them up. Oh, they're gone. All right, well, moving on.
Right. Also, if it's the Black Rock, then those people reached the island on two outriggers, then left the island, got caught in some sort of time loop. So they saw, like, all the Ajira detritus, right? Like, because there were two outriggers on the beach.
Right, and that also brings up the question, how long have these people been in a time loop? Like, have they been hopping along since... Did they go to the 50s? Did they go to 2007 twice? You know, it's really just raises more questions than it answers. So I personally am not a big fan of it. I think it would be fun, but I personally am of the effort to say, like, let's let this lie and let's let the Abby Turno stuff lie and not necessarily make the two mix with each other.
And I think for me, like, I'm good to, like, just leave this as, like, they'll answer this in Lost 2, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they'll put someone on another outrigger and they'll just start shooting at another outrigger and then we'll
but,
get
but
the,
also at
the
same time, like, I'm fine if it's unanswered. Slash, like, I'm
forever.
Fine if it. I'm fine if it is Zoe and the Mercs. Like, I don't want this to be a big thing.
Yeah, I do think Jesse Camacho had a great theory that Jesse is up front saying, like, this is not my theory, one I had read online many years ago and liked very much. And this was, like, before the final season, this had been the theory. The theory was, it's a rather romantic theory that at some point in season six, Sawyer would be on the other Outrigger being held hostage. And then the season five Outrigger appears, the people holding Sawyer captive would open fire, and season five Juliet would return fire and actually kill the person holding Sawyer hostage, ooh, thus saving him and setting him free, the message being that even in death, Juliet has Sawyer's back. I think that that is genius. I think that that is great.
Oh, I wish that would have happened.
Absolutely what should have happened. Yes. Like I love that theory. I think that would have been incredible. I think it would have underlined so many of the core thematics of the final season, and in return of the show writ large, to have this moment where even though she's gone, she's not. You're never really gone. And Juliet saving Sawyer in this moment of duress and being able to connect that, because he was there. He was there when she shot. It should be noted, by the way, that as they are receiving gunfire and Sawyer says, a little help here, Juliet picks up the rifle. She totally murders somebody. She does shoot one person. She gets a kill, for sure.
Yeah, so the question is, you know, who would that have been? Oh, I would have loved that. Even if it's just a brief period of, again, like, Zoe and the gang kidnap Sawyer, he's on the Outrigger. Hell, kill Zoe that way. Kill that Tina Fey lookalike and just have Juliet shoot her there. And then, like, Sawyer sort of gets, like, a posthumous slash currently alive nod from Juliet. And then they move forward from that. Even if it results of just, like, Sawyer being knocked out again, it would have been a fun nod, I think. And especially because season six, we largely leave that time travel stuff behind, right? We're going to stay in 2007. It would have been a nice nod, I think, back to all the shenanigans going on in the first part of the season.
Yeah, for sure. I think that would have been great. The whole moment of, like, thank you, Lord, when the flash is starting and then it's pouring rain, I take it back, is so funny.
Good. And again, only Josh Holloway could sell it, right? Like, I love him bellowing to the moon, like, thank you, Lord.
This is why, Mike, I hate the Outrigger discourse, because, like, it undercuts the fact that, like, the Outrigger scene ends brilliantly. That, like, it's so well done.
This is my hot take. I think people make too much of a big deal out of
people
the
snooze on
stuff.
This episode, I think, for sure.
Yeah, but I think in general, people are like, oh, what was in the other Outrigger? I think, again, it's maybe this idea, this sort of a lost faux pas that we often talk about focusing on the mystery instead of the characters. That I know this has become a sticking point for people, but that's why I also feel like it shouldn't be revealed, because whatever it's revealed as is not going to meet the expectations you have in your head. I guarantee it. That's what always happens with these mystery box type of shows. That's why Lost is one of, like, the rare ones to succeed, is because, you know, when you think, oh, what could this be? What could that be? And then you get the reality from the writers, it almost never measures up. And so I think the more time that passes, unfortunately, the more fervor has been built behind who was in the other Outrigger, that if and when it's revealed, everyone's going to be like, either, oh, okay, versus, or even like, that's not who I thought it was, that's stupid, versus, like, it was just a plot point that, like, these two guys are very tongue-in-cheek saying, we're never going to tell anyone about. We revealed so much, but we're never going to reveal what happened to the other Outrigger. I think we as a Lost community need to let it go, and to your point, embrace the comedy and a little bit of action-packedness that comes from whoever's firing at them. Juliet is able to play defense for a while. Sawyer, who was so belabored by the time jumps in episode one, by episode four is now thanking the powers that be for the time jump, and then immediately regretting it when they're thrust into the middle of this torrential rainstorm.
On the other side of the rainstorm, we go back to the future. It's a different kind of rainstorm that's happening in Los Angeles as Jack and Kate follow the lawyer to the destination. It's Claire's mother, Mrs. Littleton. Let's listen in as Jack and Kate are going to have a little bit of a freak out, and then Jack is going to try and, as he's wont to do, solve this situation.
Wait.
What am I waiting for, Jack?
Wait, let's just think about this for a
minute. She knows.
Maybe she doesn't
know. She knows about Aaron, and that's all that matters.
Let me go talk to her. I can just explain to her why we did it. Maybe if I can get her to understand why, she'll listen to me. I can fix this, Kate. I can fix it.
Aaron is my family too.
Hello, Miss Lou. May I come in?
Of course. You were drenched.
No, I'm fine.
God, I haven't seen you since your father's funeral. How did you even know I was here?
I knew you were here, Miss Littleton, because I followed your lawyer.
Why would you do that?
I did it because I understand that you feel the need to do this, but I need you to know that everything that Kate and I have done, it was for Aaron.
Who's Aaron? I'm afraid I'm not following you.
Miss Littleton, what are you doing here in Los Angeles?
This is completely separate from that clip, Josh. But actually, I took the time to break out my own complete collection of Lost. And yeah, I'm reading through the Black Rock Manifesto right now. And perhaps something that also helps the theory is that in December 16th, one of the crew members is complaining about headaches. And apparently other members are as well. So again, take everything with a grain of salt, the canon aspects of this, but it's just a good excuse for reminding me to dip back into my Lost complete collection, which was like sitting alongside me.
There's a lot of cool stuff in there for sure.
Yeah, maybe one day we'll do like a bonus DTH, like we'll do a video get together and like look through Lost complete collection, because there's a
Senate, an unboxing.
Yeah, Senate board in here. There's a map of the island. There's a lot of really cool stuff.
That'd be great. I think that'd be super dope. All right, back on point. So Claire's mom is here, but just because she wants to sue the shit out of Oceanic, she's got nothing to do with Aaron. This whole thing is very convoluted. I do think, like, when you try to like tug on this, like, this doesn't really hold up for me. So like, this dude is Ben's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He is trying to like, he's just trying to psych Kate out. Is it really that simple? Like, this is all just like psyops is basically what's going down.
Listen, this man is an ogre. He wants her out of his swamp. This is the easiest way to do so, through intimidation.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's too cute by half. I think all this stuff of like, oh, this is all, I mean, it's the red herring aspect, right? Like the really underlining, here's Dan Norton, like seedily dropping by Carol Littleton's motel room. Clearly she's in on it, but oh no, something's happening. It's actually Ben all along, as he sort of does his Catherine Hahn wink to the camera. I'm not a huge fan of it, though. I guess I think sort of like what we talked about last week about how Desmond meeting with Widmore is almost necessary to get Widmore to Los Angeles to sort of push forward the final part of the series. This is necessary to get Carol Littleton in the equation so that Kate can give away Aaron to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think, I guess, I suppose, I think that fits. That's fine. I just think that this plot doesn't fully track. Yeah. Like, I don't, Ben doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who is, like, kind enough to be like, Kate will be willing to come to the island if she can be made to see that, that Carol Littleton is an appropriate person to leave Aaron with. He doesn't give a shit. Like, in fact,
no, well, I think
if anything, like, probably bringing Aaron back would just, like, increase their odds of landing on the island.
Well, I think more so it's this idea of, oh, we're going to push Kate to do it because she's afraid that the truth will be revealed if she stays. You know, right. Like the walls are closing around her. It's less so like, oh, Carol Littleton will be a good person to leave Aaron with. I don't know if Ben gives two craps about Aaron at the end of the day. I think he wants Kate, and I think he wants to get to Kate through Aaron, which also I think we'll talk later about Ben's also like completely giving up the goat and being like, yep, it was me. Like, yep, you saw through it, Kate. Congratulations. I'm the one who did it, and not necessarily trying to lead her along. Maybe he felt like the jig was up at that point. But yeah, it's a lot of, we talked about this, I think, even in like season three, like overly complicated emotional manipulation. So to that point, this does feel, unfortunately, part and parcel with Ben. What I will say, though, what I did like is the first part of that clip is the Jack and Kate conversation, because this is like really out of that Jack and Kate relationship that we love and sometimes hate, right? Like the two of them arguing back and forth, Jack being insistent of like, no, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to be the one to take care of this. And Matthew Fox actually has a really beautiful pause right before he says, Aaron is my family, too. Like this is still something that he's reconciling with. And it also makes you realize from Jack's perspective in this episode, it's two-pronged in that not only is he trying to fix things, again, as the requisite leader of the Oceanic Six, who's trying to keep this lie together, but also, like, he has been sitting with his own revelation that he has a sister that he didn't know about who got left behind, that he has a nephew, basically, right now. And so I do think that there is this surprising emotional quality that Jack brings to this scene as well of, like, there are some personal connections as well from my perspective, Kate.
Right.
And so I want to be able to do this.
And I think that these are things that he's been like chewing on like quietly and privately. Right. Like this is why he's been in existential dread, like why he has been experiencing such despair. You know, we left them behind. I failed them. All of this. Oh, my God. This sister. I didn't even know she was my sister. She's still there. I have to help her. I've screwed this up. Oh, poor Aaron. Like, these are all of like sort of like those self-destructive thoughts that are going on for this guy. And now Jack finally, for the first time, with what appears to be a path back to the island. And he's right. It is, you know, he just has to keep walking down this path and he's going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
That with this path back to the island, he's finally like, he's like, it's not coincidence, like without, you know, don't mistake coincidence for fate. Like he has, he still feels like he's like slower in the way that like he feels slower than he was on the island, but he's like regaining that pep in his step to an extent. When you see him, like when him and Ben and Saeed are like leaving the hospital, like Jack is running to his car, he's speaking coherently, he's cleaned up. Like, I feel like, it's like that the island heals you type of deal is like starting to happen for him. In like physical ways, but there's also like emotionally, he is able to be like more honest and vulnerable in this moment with like Aaron's my family as well. Like that is like sort of like advanced Jack Shepherd, and I think obviously like it is still like couched in certain things where like he has not properly articulated to Kate why he is aligned with Benjamin Linus, or in fact that he is aligned with Benjamin Linus right now. He's sort of holding that close to the vest. That's not great. But you know, I do think that we are seeing Jack on the path toward being somebody who is both he's healing. We're in a healing process for him right now.
Not to mention the fact that Jack is not shy about how he has his own tempestuous relationship with his own family. And so I do think it's distinct that he says Aaron is my family too, right? That this is the idea of family has made Jack loyal, but doesn't exactly come with positive feelings, considering his relationship with his father or even his own mother. It's an opportunity, I think, maybe for Jack to also like turn over a new leaf too of like, I built this family on the island and now I know of a family that was there the entire time that I had no idea about. Like, this is an opportunity for me to make a new start
right
with that family. And so it's really therapeutic for Jack in that regard as well. I totally agree that this is like Jack getting his groove back, and it's this stark reminder in the moment that Jack's gonna end up finding out in the afterlife, which is when your time on the island was like the most important time of your life, that you're gonna build an entire afterlife around it. I think that's starting to show here, where, you know, as soon as Jack thinks about the idea of going back to the island, he's going to get a pep in his step back. He's going to jump back into that action leader mode that he was not in at the bottom of a bottle for the past 3 years. So, yeah, this is really like Jack putting on that old suit again, in a manner of speaking, and starting to become the man that he was when he got aboard the Searcher, but with maybe some more knowledge and some wisdom as to how, you know, you thought you found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but that there wasn't gold in there, and now you realize that, like, the rainbow had some good stuff going on with it.
Yeah, he's not all the way there, but he's getting there. He's approaching it. The lawyer, Claire's mom didn't hire the lawyer, so whoever's trying to take Aaron, it's not Carol Littleton. Who is it? The camera, like, cuts immediately to Ben, which is funny, and we do find out in this scene as they meet in the clandestine parking lot where all of these dastardly deeds go down that Dan Norton is Ben's lawyer. It's a funny line from Saeed, like, who is that? And Ben says, that's my lawyer.
We should note the name on the side of Ben's van means it reads Canton Rainier, C-A-N-T-O-N space R-A-I-N-I-E-R. Mix up those letters, Josh. Pull the old Hofstrawler. What does it spell? Reincarnation.
Yes, yes. They're really trying to mess with us here. They really want us to think that John Locke is going to come back to life. And the show textually is going to engage this idea as well. But cleverly, I think, you know, they know how much we love to read into so much as Lost fans, especially in the era where the show is ongoing in the week to week, that they are really playing with that idea here of like, oh, people are going to read in everything. Hofstrawler like pointed to the flash forward. So now this is going to point to John Locke is going to come back from the dead. But it's not that. And so, like, you know, is it playing fair, or is this a cheat? Well, don't forget that this game was designed by three grandmasters, and it cheats. So it's only fair if this is a little bit of a cheat. At least we've been warned.
Well, also, let's remember back in the season 3 finale when it was the same cheat method, right? Like, oh, these are flashbacks. No, wait, it's a flash forward. The show is capable of this. You know, shame on you, shame on me, that old phrase, right? Like, you've been duped once before. If you're duped twice again and you're really mad at the creators, it's your own fault for not watching Laws and thinking, like, there might be some duplicity going on behalf of the creators here. Hell, we just got it in this freaking past two scenes where we thought for two episodes that it was Carol Littleton who was the one that was sticking Dan Norton on Kate, and it turns out that it was Ben the entire time.
It was Ben all along. Back on the island, the outrigger lands on the beach. They pull up James and Juliet. They're going to plop down, lean back against the outrigger, and have a little bit of a heart-to-heart. Let's listen in.
We didn't get a chance to finish our conversation.
What conversation was that?
The one before they started shooting at us. When you were about to tell me how it felt to see Kate again.
I wasn't about to tell you anything.
Why don't you tell me now?
I was close enough to touch her.
Sane.
I know. Her nose is bleeding. That's what's wrong. What's done is done as an episode title candidate.
Oh,
what do you think?
I really like that.
You know, it's a play, what playing with the
dead,
whatever
dead
happened,
is dead,
happened.
Done is done.
Yeah, whatever happened, happened. What's done is done. You know, I like the way that they potentially intersect.
I really like that. I mean, this is great for so many reasons. Because, again, this is Sawyer moving on. In a manner of speaking, that should be noted. Another Jim Fells note. This is, I think, the first and maybe the last major theme, musically speaking, new introduced in season 5. It's sort of like a love/moving on theme for Sawyer. It essentially represents like him trying to leave the past with Kate behind and embracing a future. In this case, Juliet. You might remember this music also plays in the beginning of LaFleur when Sawyer brings that, when it's revealed that he brings the flower home to Juliet and they kiss. Like, this is going to become a big hallmark of Sawyer and Juliet's relationship. But in this moment, it represents that Sawyer, as he vocalized, what's done is done. He has realized, much like John Locke has vocalized, there's no use changing the past. All you can do is look forward. And at this moment, no matter where or in what state Kate is, that part of his life is over and they need to move forward, especially with the growing urgency that the people around him are possibly dying due to nosebleeds.
Yeah. Is this musically connected to season six? It certainly sounds like it.
A little bit.
It sounds like the moving on music, as people are like reconnecting in the flash sideways.
Yeah, I can imagine it's connected. I don't think Jim Fell showed the, you know, We'll Go Dutch, but I would imagine it's at least a little connected to that.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah, it's very much the Soaring Strings very much like make an appearance here. And it's very similar themes, right? Of looking back, but then more pertinently looking forward and moving on.
Well, I love the scene for both of the characters, but I would like to take some time to like talk about why I love it so much for Juliet. I love the way where she's like, you were gonna tell me about how close you were, right? You were gonna tell me what it felt like. Like, this is like, they are like, she's probably starting to get, you know, she's going to have the nosebleed. Is she starting to feel a little bit of like the delirium that is associated with the time sickness? Or is it even more simply than that? Like, once again, fate has loosed her. She's Charlie Brown trying to kick the thing, and she was about to get off the island once again. And once again, she is stuck on this flipping island, and she just like wants to be like reminded of what it was like to be alive and be around love again.
Yeah, so
she's like, tell me what that was like. I think that's really beautiful. It's a really like romantic moment for both of the characters, even as they are not in love with each other yet. I feel like these are just both, they're two people who just really want to be loved, even if like Sawyer would never like come out and say it, you know, like he just wants to be loved, man. And so does Juliet. And I think it's a really, really great scene for both of the characters. You know, rightfully, LaFleur gets a ton of credit as far as like, you know, putting the final touches on making them Facebook official. But like, I think like you don't get to LaFleur if you don't have scenes like this. You need scenes like this to make it believable that these two people would have fallen in love. And I think that this scene is really, really effective in that effort.
Yeah, I should also note, I was looking it up, the season six connection on Lostpedia, and I believe Jim Fells did this as well, there's actually a surprising connection to an episode you mentioned before. This actually pops up surprisingly in The Last Recruit, in the scene where Desmond's in the well and Saeed's about to kill him. So
yeah,
there's some connection there, I suppose, when it comes to moving on and finding love. But no, it doesn't seem like it's specifically connected to the moving on stuff from the end.
Got it. Okay. No sweat. Charlotte sees all of this wreckage on the beach. Does anybody speak French? Well, if we hit 550 patrons by the end of June, Mike Bloom will embark on the journey to speak French, Charlotte.
I'll travel back in time and I'll answer that question for her after I fired on her in the outrigger.
Mike, are we going to chronicle this adventure in podcast form?
I think that would be fun if we did a little bit of like a check-in. I don't know what the word check-in is.
What would we call it?
I don't know.
French Mike Bloom.
French Mike Bloom, FMB.
Yeah, French Mike Bloom, I think is what it will be called. French Mike Bloom. Do you want French Mike Bloom? 550 patrons by the end of June.
and then what I will be able to do is then I'll be able to recite the next scene word for word.
Yeah. What will the podcast entail? Will you just like watch a lot of like French media, like French movies, French TV shows?
Yeah, I'm gonna embark on the film background of one Gérard Depardieu.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
That's really gonna be my access point.
Uh huh. Are you saying that because you believe he's the only French actor?
That's it, right? Like, you can only elect one person from your country.
You'll find out as you embark on that journey. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Make it happen. French Mike Bloom. Out on the ocean, we see Danielle Rousseau's team discover Jin. He's alive!
Yeah, so this was... I mean, we talked about this a little bit during GEON. It was this weird thing where, like, DDK didn't do any preseason press, like he wasn't part of the marketing materials. But I do seem to recall that at least one of these previous three episodes, Josh, DDK was credited in. So I think, like, it's not exactly on the level of what they did with Harold Perrineau, but I think people assumed that Jin would be back in some form.
I don't love this, to be honest. I think that probably this stuff with Jin is the weakest part of the episode for me. Or among the weakest parts.
I think the final scene I really like. I think it's this scene. This is a weird scene.
It's a little
scene
anticlimactic.
And it's a weird placement as well. Like, you could, I actually wrote in my notes, I'm like, you could end this the episode right here. Like, you could very easily do, it's not as strong as the I'm a Danielle Rousseau thing, but you could do, like, here's a crew speaking French. You can kind of put two and two together. And the big reveal is that Jin's alive. It's not that, oh, we're with young Danielle Rousseau. You could very easily do that. Instead, this almost feels like a
soft ending.
It's almost
like they know. It's almost like they know, like, everyone knows Jin's fine.
Exactly. We screwed the pooch on that one, so let's just sort of get it out of the way. But yeah, so we have this raft in the middle of the ocean. You know, we hear a couple of names thrown around, Montand with both arms, Robert, and then they bring in someone. It's Jin. We'll talk about this in the ending. You know, this is the second time that Jin has washed ashore somewhere. Of course, in the beginning of season two, looks a lot worse here than he did at the beginning of season two.
Well, yeah, he's been not only apparently, you know, out here for days, but he has also been traveling through time. You know, he has been traveling through time. I don't know how long we want to say that they've been traveling through time for, even if it's like a solid day.
Yeah, because you can't really say, like, a day and a night, right? Because it'll go from night to day, back to night.
They haven't slept. Like, they're all exhausted. Like, he also got, partially exploded.
probably still in shock from that.
Yeah, you know, he got, like, knocked off of an exploding boat. That's how he's alive. So he is, like, rightfully looking a little haggard here. Poor Jin. We'll check back in with Jin at the end of the episode, which is very soon from now. This is the penultimate scene, is at the marina, as everybody's converging. We're converging at the marina. This is the meeting point where we are going to see Kate shows up, Jack shows up, they show up together. She wants to know why you called me. He tells her about the address in the attacker's pocket. She's like, Saeed's here? He's like, yeah, and it's not just Saeed, Ben's here too. She's like, excuse me? Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, he's going to help us go back. We're going to go back. Remember when I said we have to go back? And yeah, she's like, yeah, but this asshole's been trying to kidnap my son. She puts it together instantly.
She sees it straight through Ben's bullshit. And again, I think maybe the
and
reason
Jack's
why...
like, come on. And Ben's like, yeah, no, she's absolutely correct.
And I think the reason why he does that, probably a lot of reasons, right? One is that, like, he knows he's been caught, so there's no use trying to convince Jack, like, no, she's lying. I would never do that. Maybe he also had some admiration as well of, like, good on you, Kate. Good for putting the clues together, because the audience certainly didn't up until we actually saw them in the parking garage together.
Yeah, I dislike Ben's plan here very much. I think Ben is being very sloppy here. With his attempt.
I'm telling you, it's very season three Ben, right? Where like he is so, at that moment though, Ben was so on top that he thought like he could do no wrong, that he made things overly complicated. Here, maybe it's sort of like him spiraling, right? Like he's so desperate that he's making mistakes along the way because, yeah, I mean, right after this scene, I think we'll see in next episode, like Kate immediately leaves with Aaron and it's like, I'm not doing this BS
anymore. Yeah, I'm not doing this. What do you think who do you think I am? You crazy person. So she's rightfully going to be pretty upset about this, and she's not going to want to be involved. Saeed is sort of just, like, quietly here, just sort of, like, taking it all in. And meanwhile, Sun is in a nearby car with the gun, the Forrest Gump, as Aaron is just, like, passed out in the back of the car.
Looks like he got tranked. Are we sure that they're not just slipping this kid tranked darts in his scrambled eggs or something?
I'm not sure. I would suspect that it's possible that that is exactly what's going on here.
I love that they lampshade that actually in the very first sound that we played, right? Where Kate's just like holding up the baby. She's like, oh no, you can talk at full volume. Like he can literally sleep through anything.
He can sleep through anything. So I do think that this is bad on Sun. She's brought this kid to a potential gunfight. It's not great.
Yeah, but maybe they had to do it, because what I do enjoy is that we actually cut from Sun to Jin. I like that link. Just maybe the presence of Sun here was not worth the transition.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. All right, final scene of the episode. It's daylight now. The rain is gone. Rain, go away. Jin is going to wake up with the crew, and we are going to find out who these people are with a very pointed reveal at the end of the episode and the end of this sound. Sound 8.
4. Robert! Yeah, the snail vient de l'île.
6. Tu peux déterminer la source?
Sûr que oui.
Regarde. Tu crois qu'il est habité?
Ça va?
Je sais pas.
Comment tu te sens?
No, I understand.
You speak English?
A little.
Are you okay?
Yes.
How did you get here?
Boat.
Qui est-ce?
On s'en fout qui c'est. Qu'est-ce qu'il fait ici?
Il dit qu'il est venu en bateau.
What boat? It's gone. I think.
It must have been caught in the same storm as ours.
Who are you? How long you were in the water?
I don't know.
How do you not know how you wound up in the middle of the ocean, huh?
Mon temps, laisse-le, il est en état de choc. On a de l'eau à lui donner.
Ouais. Tiens.
Merci, Robert. What is your name?
Guan Jinsu. Jin.
Hello, Jin. I'm Daniel. Daniel Russo.
Did somebody Slack message Jin as we were listening to that?
Jin, you're traveling through time. Just want to let you know. And Jin's like, I'm going to leave this. It's impolite to look at my messages at the moment. I'm going to leave this on
red. No, I just
want to
know if I'm a psychopath who heard a Slack message, or if that was real.
I was getting Slack from the other outrigger. They just said, like, mission failed. We couldn't get the target. I'm so right. Sorry, boss.
A Slack cameo in our audio capturing process, I think, which is fantastic. I love the idea of someone...
Cut me some Slack, okay? Yeah. We're recording this in the middle of the day.
I love the idea of somebody Slacking Jin. And Jin's like, sorry, Danielle, I just need to respond to this. It's my boss.
Do you think the Slack would say 4/8/15/16/23/42? And
it's
just
my
like,
boss.
Like the numbers coming out of the transmission in the radio?
Just give me a minute. It's my boss. I gotta take this real quick. Yeah, so it's Danielle Russo. And so like it's exciting because like they had always promised we would find out. And so like we kind of thought it would be the Danielle Russo flashback episode, but it is something different. It is we are going to live through Danielle's past, which is definitely a clever twist.
I love this ending so much because
yeah, it's great.
This entire episode, right, was about doting on things that we have seen before. The time period that they traveled through in terms of the past was stuff that we've experienced in season one. Now this is something that we heard about, but we have not directly experienced,
right.
Which I feel like is a little different. With stuff with Jughead, we knew that Charles Widmer was a part of it and we saw Richard Alpert, but like we had no idea there were stories about, oh, there was a bomb back on the days of the island. This, we heard Danielle Russo in solitary talk about what happened to her crew, and that's what also makes us scary as well, as obviously we know Jin makes it out alive, but the end of the story that Danielle Russo says is that, like, everyone went crazy and killed each other on her science expedition, and now Jin is right in the middle of that. He is out of the frying pan and into that fire.
Yes. Yes, he is. All right. So that's The Little Prince. I really liked this one. I liked it even a little tiny bit more than The Lie, I think, because we're getting into our 4.2 stars ratings. I gave The Lie a 3.6. I'm giving this just a smidge higher, a 3.7. I think it's a really underrated episode. I think like it's got that forward momentum. It's got a lot of really powerful scenes littered throughout. I think it is like further reinforcing my feeling, Mike, that like so much of Lost season 5 kind of like hovers around this quality zone.
Yeah. I agree. I gave this a 3.7, which is a little bit above The Lie for me, and actually on the same level that I gave Jughead last week. Though again, if you held a gun to my head, I would say I like The Little Prince more, just because I think for me.
Do you want to take that stand? Feel free, man. Like, go, yeah, go wild.
I think it's just because for me, The Little Prince contains more stuff of what I like about Lost than maybe Jughead does. Again, I think they're very strong episodes. I both gave them the same rating.
Delineate it, Mike. If you think Little Prince is better than Jughead, you should say so. You should do that in your ratings. Why not? Live
right.
A little.
3.8. 3.8, yeah, for Little
do
Prince.
It. Why
let's
not?
Make it
let's
happen.
Go. Let's go wild.
Well, I don't know if I'd go full Wiggler and give it like a 3.71 or something. You
do
know?
What you got. Do what you got to do. You know. I think that's the way to go.
Somebody,
you gotta live your truth.
I really like this episode. I really like discussing it with you as well. I think this is a very, like, there's so many great things hidden in this, especially things that are going to call forward to bigger character moments down the line. Again, I think Jughead does a great job of calling forward to plot moments. This calls ahead to think a lot of big character decisions that are going to happen as immediate as the next couple weeks in the case of John Locke. So I think it actually is a really special episode in that regard.
No, special with season one.
No, and with the very much not alive Michael. It's very much on the same level with me as like a G Eon is what I would compare it to. Where like there's some really strong character stuff going on. Is it perfect? No, there are definitely elements that I'm not a fan of, but the strengths very much outweigh the weaknesses. But Josh, I would overall say, compared to our listeners, you and I are pretty dang high on The Little Prince, comparatively speaking.
Yeah, it's a 3.4 average for the listenership that goes. How low does it go? How low can you go? A 3 is as low as it goes. Fine. Like, we're still in, like, the 3s or higher. Like, you know, season 5, so hot right now.
Yeah, I mean, so far, yeah, we've given, like, I've given a 4, a 3.6, a 3.7, and a 3.8. This might be the strongest start to a Lost season that I have experienced so far from a ratings perspective.
Across the sea. Across these four episodes so far. I'm just doing a quick scan, Mike.
Well, I mean, season one, we had like 4.2s and 4s with Walkabout
Rabbit. That's not what I'm going for. Across these four episodes, just looking at the scores from the audience, the lowest score given for any single one of these four episodes, and I'm doing the quick scan, I'm double checking, I'm looking, is a 2.8 is the lowest that it goes for any episode. And that is the only score in the twos so far through four episodes of season five of Lost. That's what I'm saying is like season five is just of a quality level that is very consistent. As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, which is ironic considering that like we are jumping around everywhere. You'd think the quality would as well, but no, it has been incredibly solid.
It's pretty tight. You know, some of it's wonky. Like, you know, we're about to get into some of like, wait, that's how they're going to get back to the island? That doesn't really stand to reason. But like, you know, like you put some of that on the shelf or like you are able to like kind of like wrap your arms around it and be like, all right, Lost, you big weirdo, come here. Like, I think like once you can like get over that, like I think a lot of the plotting is really, really, really sharp. And you can tell that a lot of effort went into like weaving all of this.
So all that being said, 3.7 from you, 3.8 from me, 3.4 from the listeners, averages out to 3.63, finishes above The Lie, number 3 at the moment.
Yes, number 3 at the moment. Okay, before we get into some feedback and start winding down here, a quick word from our sponsors. Those are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Well, sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners and renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Mike, let us talk about this episode with some feedback from the listeners. This comes our way from Dallin Servo. The great Dallin Servo writes in and says, how is it that Jin is the only survivor of the freighter explosion, and how long has Jin been floating? Mike, is it possible that other people survived the freighter explosion?
I mean, if they did, I think they might have died for various reasons. I mean, let me go with, again, the Occam's razor. I think the reason that Jin survived is because he had to. Is because he has to go back to the 70s and be a part of that entire Dharma crew, right? So because of the fact that he has to do that, that's why he survives the freighter explosion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He exists in the 70s, and therefore he must survive here. I like to think that other people, like, survived and, like, they fought it out on this little sliver of scrap, and Jin was the only one who made it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was also Jin, right? The guy who threatens violence so many times. Like, I think if he needs to do it, he'll get scrappy and, like, slit a couple throats if need be.
Yes. If that's what he had to do. Dallin also asks, did Ben intentionally pick the same lawyer as Claire's mom, or was it just a coincidence? I would expect that Ben, like, unleashed his lawyer on Claire's mom.
Yeah,
like,
I would imagine
you
that
should
this
sue
is
Oceanic. You know, this is all part of, like, scrambling her brain.
Do not mistake coincidence for fate. I do think that, like, the timing is also very suspect as well, right? The Carol Littleton happens to show up here within the 70-hour window. Like, I think this was all planning on Ben's part. It just becomes incredibly clear immediately.
Yeah. Daniel Brennan says, what the hell is Ben doing at the marina with regard to Kate? He makes it seem like he's trying to take Aaron away out of principle rather than as a ploy to bring Kate back into the fold. Yeah, Daniel, thank you for articulating that for me. Because what Ben does with Kate, like, really sits poorly with me as far as, like, I always have a plan. Well, your plan sucks, man.
Well, even that, or the tactic for Kate to be like, you know, why don't you leave me and my son alone? Because he's not your son, Kate. Like, that very much seems like negging, almost, to be like, here's a reminder of why you should come back with me, because he's not even your stupid son to begin with, Kate.
Yeah. It's just not great. It's not great. From Bob, Bob says, what did you think about the fact that the exchange between Jack and Claire's mom was not included in the script? Oh, I didn't know this. Could Jack have been lying to Kate about Carol Littleton's intentions? Was he working in cahoots with Ben at that moment and said the only thing that could motivate Kate to come with him to the marina?
I don't know.
That's too big brain for Jack Shepard, I think.
Yeah, I think at this moment, Jack is not like the criminal mastermind that Benjamin Linus is. I agree. I don't think it's within Jack's capacity.
No.
And Jack is also a bad liar to begin with. Like, he's not going to be able to get away with that, specifically to someone like Kate, who can see right through him.
From Ben, the Ben Martell behind the curtain, Ben says, would you have enjoyed it if this Sawyer made an appearance in Do No Harm talking to Kate and it didn't pay off until season 5? In another world, that's cool, but, like, that's, like, not when Lost was made. Like, if Lost was made now, it was, like, a shorter seasoned type of show. It's, first of all, a very different show.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, like, this is, like, if you've got, like, 30 episodes across 3 seasons, if you're, like, a certain Netflix time travel show, maybe, then, yeah, like, that goes down. But there's no world where that would have happened in season 1. And I think probably for me in season 1, maybe this is strange to say, it almost would have been too weird.
Yeah. Well, I also think just from a character perspective, like, no, I don't like this. Sorry, Ben. I think the message of this is, like, there is no messing with your own past. Because not only whatever happened happened, this is more of like an emotional whatever happened in this episode, right? It's like, don't affect your past because your past made you who you are. I like the fact that Sawyer doesn't do anything. Because not only does that help from a paradoxical perspective, it also just, like, is a symbol of a clean break and being able to move on from those ghosts, even if the ghosts themselves cannot move on. If Sawyer does end up talking to Kate, even if it shows up in season 1, like, that's representative of the fact that Sawyer didn't do that, and I don't like that choice.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Let's do the MVP, LVPs, Mike.
Before we do that, actually, I want to point out one quick thing, because at the time, Josh, this episode, for some reason, season 5, episode 4, was the beginning of a pretty big hallmark of Losty pop culture, you know, online-only features. This was the first episode to feature a recap done in the style of Lost Untangled.
Lost Untangled. Oh, the puppet show.
Yeah, it didn't start as the puppet show, though. So for those that don't know, Lost Untangled was a series of recap episodes done by ABC in a comical fashion. And the first instances of them were actually done with, like, comic book style, and they were done with action figures of the characters. So we'll actually post this in the show notes, but, like, the one for The Little Prince, for example, has Locke and Sawyer doing their conversation, but it's the Locke action figure and the Sawyer action figure talking to each other. I think it's in season 6 that we bring out the Pierre Cheng puppet.
Interesting. Okay.
So, yeah, it's weird. I don't know why you don't begin it in season 5, episode 1. I don't know why season 5, episode 4 is where you choose to start it, but for us Losties at the time, this was like a fun little thing that I think we can still dote on to this day.
All right, let's do the MVP LVPs. I've got 3 MVPs. You've got 2. You've got 3 LVPs. I've got 2.
I've got 2, babe.
I'll reveal 2 of mine right off the bat. 1 to Juliet, 1 to Sawyer. I think it's a great Juliet and Sawyer episode. Juliet just, like, handles Sawyer so well. They're, like, in lockstep with one another when she, like, gets the gun out. She's shooting on the outrigger. She's just, like, really good about, like, sending him away when he needs to be sent away and bringing him back in when he needs to open up to somebody. And for Sawyer, I think this is just, like, this is more than anything just, like, an incredible Josh Holloway performance that I definitely want to stand up and salute. So 1 to Juliet, 1 to Sawyer, straight out the gate from me.
And for that reason, I'm going to give one of my MVP points to Kate, due in part to the fact that she does immediately suspect Ben, which again is a lot to put together, but good on her. But I also think Evangeline Lilly does a great job here. She's going to get to her more of her powerhouse scene later on, as we spoke about earlier, but I think, you know, this is a good place for Kate as a performer, not as a character, to be in. And so, you know, I rarely give kudos to Kate, apparently, according to our previous points. So allow me to you know, make up for that by throwing a point onto her here in a Kate-centric episode.
I tossed my final point onto Jin, because he's alive!
Yay!
He survived! Escaped. That required some work.
Apparently, so, according to our canon, like, a lot of bloodshed as well.
Yeah, so I feel like Jin deserves a point for being alive.
Yes, exactly. Come through Stephen Sondheim. I'm going to give my final MVP point to John Locke. I think the John Locke, then this and next episode, like, he's got a clear mission. He does a very good job sort of rallying the troops and getting everyone to work together and work forward towards this greater purpose. And so I think it's been a good streak of episodes for John Locke. Ironically enough, he lost his people, but he's starting to gain his footing again in the points.
He is. That's great. Good for Locke. Yeah, we've got a 5-way tie for first place right now. It's Locke, Sawyer, and Juliet, who are all worthy contenders for MVP, certainly of this stretch of the season, if not the whole season. And then Carmen and David Reyes are still in the conversation, which is awesome. All right, LVPs, you've got 3. Give us a go.
I'm gonna do what you did. I'm gonna give out 2 immediately, both going to Law and Order. I think in retrospect, I would give this and the one from the premiere to specifically Dan Norton. But I think just in general, I'm going to keep it general with Law and Order.
That's easy enough to fix if you want to just switch this specifically
to
Dan Norton.
Dan Norton, one, for being an ogre, and, and 2, for not having a case that holds any water, unlike an outrigger.
Yes, okay. Dan Norton, you suck. You deserve all of the LVP points, but at least you get these two here.
You typed in damn Norton there.
Damn Norton. Damn Norton is almost what I did. I already said this, I'm giving an LVP to Sun. The endangerment of Aaron, I just don't love. And I also just, I don't, this direction for the character just never really bears fruit for me. And I give my other LVP point, maybe not a surprise given how I was talking about him earlier in the episode, to Benjamin Linus. I think like his whole Kate thing, like, I do think like he kind of blows it here.
It's not a good plan. And I guess it ends up sort of like working incidentally, right? Because maybe seeing Carol Littleton got Kate's brain ticking as to giving him up, but it wasn't his doing necessarily. I don't think he intended for Kate to follow Dan Norton to the motel to meet with Carol Littleton. And I don't think it's a surprise, though I think there probably will be some disagreement from the other person here. I'm going to give an LVP point to Miles. I know that you said you liked that scene, but I feel like every other scene he was annoying to me, whether it was him complaining about the paddling or like always having a remark. This is more so a I'm annoyed by this character in this episode thing. And let me also continue the trend here. Miles got so many LVP points in season 4. Let's keep that train going in season 5.
All right, Dan Norton comes close to the bottom of the barrel here in season 5 so far, but he's still outclassed by both Widmore and Frogert. And I don't know if Dan Norton appears again, so that may have been our only shot at Dan Norton. And we've got that 5-way tie in first place. We'll see if that moves at all next week when we embark on This Place is Death.
So this is the one with Rousseau's crew, right? That's like the main to-do mm-hmm. in this episode.
There's that. There's also going to be, I believe, well, Charlotte certainly dies, and I believe that Locke is going to turn the wheel.
I do believe as well. So this is going to be episode. This is going to be our farewell to the
John Locke's
the
final episode on the island. Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, it's a big episode in many ways. I mean, again, we're coming off a really solid stretch here in our in both of our opinions. I'll be intrigued to see where This Place is Death lines up with us as we start to bid adieu to the first part of this season already.
Yes, we're already moving on. So This Place is Death, landing in the Down the Hatch feed on June 11th. It will be early on June 9th for the patrons of post-show recaps. If we haven't convinced you today to sign up, I don't know how we can. We actually do have some ideas up our sleeves, but this is a pretty good incentive. Get Mike Bloom to do French Mike Bloom. He's going to learn French. He'll podcast about it. It's going to be fantastic. 550 patrons by the end of June.
For the occasion as well.
Yeah, we'll figure out the specifics as we're developing this on the fly. French Mike Bloom, 550 patrons by the end of June. Let's make this happen. Let's spread the word. Get your friends, get your family, get everybody on board. We need to right this wrong. Mike Bloom should have known French by now. It's about to happen. It's going to happen. We're going to make it happen. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. More seriously, it is the start of a month. It's the perfect time to sign up. You are going to get a lot of value out of $5 a month for that podcast feed. You will get tremendous value out of that $10. And at $15, you can get yourself on the track for a Wigglers Wombats hat or a post-show recaps hat, should you choose. So lots of different options. Your support means the world if you are able to support us. It's just impossible for us to overstate how much it means to us. Patreon.com/post-show recaps. Anything you are able to do to support the show is just tremendous. Get your feedback in for next week's show. Down the Hatch at postshowrecaps.com. Send that in by June 8th if you can. You can also hit us up on Twitter at postshowrecaps. I'm at Ron Howard. Mike is at a Mike Bloom type. Mike, you are embarking on another islandish or island adjacent adventure in your podcasting as Survivor South Africa is kicking up with a brand new season. First major new season of Survivor in quite some time, Mike.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. It's very season 5-esque, right? Where, like, it's island-based in that it's Survivor, but it actually, due to obvious restrictions, is taking place in the country of South Africa. So it's almost, like, based back in the homeland, as it were. But yeah, we're getting new Survivor on our screens, people. For the first time in over a year, Survivor South Africa is back. So will myself and Shannon Gus. At the time you're listening to this, the premiere is already out, baby. So go check that out if you're into reality TV and you have been missing the show as much as we have. It's a really fun series slash part of the franchise. If you haven't embarked on it yet, love Survivor South Africa. And we've got weekly content coming your way as well. If you want to hear me talk for another couple of hours a week for whatever reason about island-based shenanigans, I'm there. So you can also inquire with me if you want to find a way to watch them. We have the means. I've got my people in the Outrigger to take care of it for you.
Awesome. Amazing.
So that's
He'll slack you. That's what Mike's got going on. So much going on post-show recaps. We did just launch the 24 podcast, Worst Day Ever. Stressful 24-minute spoiler-free recaps of 24 Season 1 with myself and the great Emily Fox. Really fun podcast. I encourage you to listen if you loved 24, if you watched it, even if you haven't watched it and you don't plan on watching it, or if you haven't watched it and you want to check it out, this is the podcast for you. I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's a low commitment, a really easy listen each and every every week. Especially if you double time it, you're done inside of 12 minutes. That's crazy. So check out that podcast. It comes out on Mondays. Really, really psyched about it. We hope you enjoy it as well. Next week, This Place Is Death, which I'm going to say exactly like that multiple times next week. I'm really, really pumped to talk about it. Season 5, so lit right now, Mike.
Absolutely. Lighten up. Though we're going to get a little smoky next week as a very, 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 very important character in the next two, you know, this season and next season of Lost, Josh, is finally going to make his appearance.
Oh, my God. All right. We will be back next week with the Smoke Monster with so much more in This Place Is a Death. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.